This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.
T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff.
Liftoff.
Hey now, this is Weekend Confirmed. My name is Garnet Lee. Glad to be here with you sharing the summer of 2013. Mr. Jeff Cannata off now on his Australian adventure. Lots of you probably roaming around the San Diego Convention Center having a great time at Comic-Con. It's the one big thing I think of geekdom, nerddom, whichever way you want to call it, that I have not ever been to. So I'm super jealous of all of you down there. Have a great time. We got a great show for you coming up today. It is the summertime. There are not a tremendous number of new releases, but props to you guys. You filled up the question thread the first one of the week with some awesome questions. There's lots that we want to talk about, and we've been playing some games. To join me, I have got Mr. Jeff Mattis here.
Hey, everybody. It is awesome to be here.
And Mr. Christian Spicer.
Hey, quick shout out to my beautiful and wonderful wife, who when this comes out, it will be our 10-year wedding anniversary.
Oh.
So I got that up front because she's not going to listen to the whole show to hear that as a finishing move. Thank you, guys.
Congratulations. Yeah. Love you guys. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun.
That is really awesome. Well, I'm going to do a shout out. I'm going to do a little shout out to a longtime friend of ours in the industry and friend of mine from San Francisco, Ethan Ironhorn, who made a really nice Facebook post randomly just out of nowhere about how much he enjoys listening to this show and how it's a great source of like video game news and information and just like part of sharing the culture. So thanks a lot, Ethan. That's pretty awesome, dude.
Yeah.
Much appreciated. All right. So we have like sort of a plan to go through, but again, it's summertime, so there's lots going on. And sometimes the random things that come up are the best. And as we're getting ready for the show here today, we always do like some sound checks. We do level checks. You're like talking, right? And Mike is there in the booth. He's getting everything geared up for us, of course. And Jeff Mattis leans forward and says,
"Terrorists win."
And I thought, you know, I used to love Counter-Strike, and they tried Counter-Strike Go, and was that Go, right?
CS:GO, yeah.
CS:GO. They've tried a number of different iterations, but really it pinnacled, I think, at 1.6.
Yeah, yeah. During mid-beta, you know, even before final release, I think.
That game was best before it came out.
Well, no, I mean, you know, it was...
Truth of many games, Christian. Truth of many games.
It was, I mean, that was when I was playing it,
yeah.
You know, the hardest. It was, you know, I was on a team and clans and, you know, matches and tournaments and stuff. It was, you know...
Yeah, so without sounding like really ridiculous, like, can Counter-Strike ever come back? Which, of course, is sort of silly because Counter-Strike never went away and there's still a core community that plays it really hard. What happened, though, to that, or maybe not what happened to, but what do you think the likelihood would be of a game being able to bring back some of that more practiced element, that more patient element that Call of Duty totally wiped out, right? And SOCOM used to be where the console player who wanted a more deliberate game went, where the player who wanted a more... hey, where I am and what I do and how I shoot and my ability to aim and use weapons
right.
tactically really matters would go. But I feel like at least for the mainstream player, mm-hmm. that's gone away. I don't know where did they go and could it come back?
Well, I think a lot of that game's success you can attribute to the fact that it was a free mod. And,
yeah,
and it was –
that's a good point.
When it was ramping up initially, it was like everybody's like, oh, what's this thing? And you get in there and it's a really tight experience. It's really highly competitive. The rounds are, you know, I mean, it's a one shot, one kill thing more or less. And the rounds are really quick. It's just,
right.
It's a really tight experience, but I don't know how you sell that as a full retail. I mean, even the,
well, look, Desert Storm, we got Battlefields and we've got Battlefields coming out of our ears.
That's true. But we've never had like a Counter-Strike campaign or a Counter-Strike, anything, you know, outside of the multiplayer component of it. That's been really solid. I mean, they know they have bots and stuff, but there's no narrative, there's no sort of, you know, thing that there's a lot
of all those fucking Arctics. That's what killed it, right? Right. I knew those bastards were going to eventually ruin the game.
I feel like it's a couple of things. One, I think that some elite Call of Duty players are probably screaming that Call of Duty does have that.
Of course it does.
It's faster play, but there are
The elite Call of Duty. I thought you were going to say Counter-Strike. So elite Call of Duty players are saying that it mirrors
that. There's tactics and there's aiming, and it's not – I mean, it's easy to dumb down and be like, oh, well, you know, on consoles it has a pretty helpful auto aim and you just got to find
streaks.
The one spot.
Streaks, man.
That's all you got to – but I mean, I think that's discounting the skill of those players. There's a reason why when I log in, I just get my ass handed to me. And they have skill and there's tactics, and if you play against a clan, you're going to get your ass mopped versus with random. So I think there's some of that.
Now, before anyone else says it, though, I want to say that my point was not that it's a skill differentiation, because I think there is a skill to playing Call of Duty as well. It's a different style. It's like two different types of painting. It's watercolors and
oil. It's like a slower-paced game versus
it's just a different game.
Well, Call of Duty is much lower barrier of entry. I mean, you can get in there, and even if you suck, you can get a couple kills, and you can feel like you're sort of getting on the horse a little bit.
Well,
I don't know if I agree. You can get a couple of kills, but you'll get killed 30 times, whereas Counter-Strike –
You get killed once per match.
Right, and that's all it is.
True.
And even
that's
the best player, that can happen too sometimes. But I think that the second thing, and that maybe listeners have no – I can look it up over the break. I'd be curious to know what Counter-Strike's numbers were during its peak versus what – because I feel like something that we all played that was in the zeitgeist that was like, this is everything. But that was also before shooters or console gaming maybe exploded the way it did, and Call of Duty became – you know, a Madden, a Call of Duty, like that was a game that everybody plays. It's ubiquitous. Whereas, you know, what
are... So you're saying smaller group size in general, that just the audience was smaller?
I think
we were all tighter knit. Was like easier for like as a community for us to hop game to game.
Well, I wonder how much that community has fallen off, honestly.
The Counter-Strike? No, Counter-Strike still has an active community.
So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I wonder like what its peak was and how much
you're saying
it's
that we've gotten
off.
So much bigger that while it's still there, it's now dwarfed by the larger size of the gaming audience, and so it doesn't seem as big as it was in its era.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you.
Right.
I don't know that. I have no facts to back it up.
And I didn't want to get too much into the Counter-Strike thing just per se, because my thought was really, even if that's the case, why have we gone away from that so completely? Like, what happened to even the Tom Clancy games? What happened to that audience? Rainbow Six Vegas. Rainbow Six Vegas games were really fun. Now, I'm not saying that they are in a Counter-Strike world completely, but there's certainly somewhere between Call of Duty and Counter-Strike. I mean, they're in there where you're still playing tactically. The terrorist hunt missions are very much like, you know where you are, use the map well, use your building and cover and set up your sight lines and all that sort of stuff. And I feel like that's still really interesting and fun.
I think maybe it's in the mainstream game, it's the draw towards what Nintendo called the Blue Ocean, or the more mainstream gamer. Like, so those AAA games are going towards that, where those other experiences that are slower paced and require more time, because Jeff and I were actually talking about this before the show.
Right.
Because some of the indie games he plays, I'm like, I understand them and I know why they exist. I think they're great for the industry, but to me it feels like work. I'd rather go kill some dudes in God of War. And I think maybe some of that is true for these shooters too, where it's just it's work. And if you put in that time, it's great. I mean, I know you've invested in World of Tanks.
It's maybe a little bit of work, because look, no one wants it. I get it. It's not fun to be the guy, you know, running through the courtyard, trying to get to the bomb site and be plunked.
Right. And then wait 5 minutes.
But yeah. once you have learned the way that the game is played and where maps are played, so you're no longer that guy, because you know not to go running up that corridor, right? You go, I don't go running up through here because that's the spot that the snipers are watching.
Right.
And then after that, then the tactics start to really develop, because you're starting to learn, I know where I need to be, and it takes on a whole new sort of color.
So I just thought of this, and maybe this is completely wrong. I wonder if those people that want that, are they playing Dota and Leagues now?
Mm. Oh, I bet you a lot of them are, yeah.
And Leagues is huge. I mean, it's...
You're saying, so there's a transference of, maybe I'm not playing a first-person shooter, but I am playing a game where, yeah, I'm going to get beat up. I'm going to get bloodied the first couple of three times. But then after that, I'm going to understand the way the game... That's actually exactly what MOBAs...
Or start to understand.
Yeah, start to understand it. And that's where the game actually starts.
Well, and
because then things start to happen.
And truly competitive e-sport-like games all have that in common. I mean, I would argue that, you know, Call of Duty is sort of... tries to capture a lot of that in a more mainstream way, but it is not as punishing. It is not a you know, thing that you feel like you have to get in and learn and really, really, you know, I don't know. It doesn't feel like you're
It has a lower barrier of entry.
Yeah, you can get in there and shoot some dudes get out and
at the same time, you may not be playing it very elegantly. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Yoon has made it through the 405 forest and arrived here in the studio.
I mean, usually a lot faster. At this hour.
It is oftentimes faster, but however, there's a lot of construction going on there in the hill, and I guess the 405 is a wreck. Anyone who lives in LA knows that. Anyway, good to have you here. We launched in a weird conversation about what happened to whether or not more practiced pace shooters would ever have a place again like they did during the Counter-Strike era.
I mean, have any of you guys played Last of Us multiplayer?
No.
No.
Not yet.
I think that's a pretty interesting thing because the first thing that I thought of when I played that was, wow, this sort of reminds me of Counter-Strike, you know?
Interesting.
Get out of here with your examples.
Yeah.
Well, okay, and Assassin's Creed 3 or Assassin's Creed multiplayer, when they introduced that, that was actually a pretty cool, you know, you have to learn how to play it and it's a little bit more intricate and you can't just run around like a jackass and, you know, or you can, but you're not going to do well. So, I mean, I think that there are examples of that, but anything that goes beyond like the sort of shooter milieu is automatically considered niche when it comes to online multiplayer stuff because that's where most of the audience is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's definitely possible for those games to exist and I think they will continue to exist, but they're, you know, the biggest mainstream example of that is never going to be as, you know, intricate and involved and skill requisite, you know, I don't think.
I get it. I mean, I think that also one of the pieces that is a differentiation between those two is, look, in Call of Duty, the weapons are celebrated for how fun they are and climbing up through the weapon ranks and customizing them and all those sorts of pieces. And in Counter-Strike, the weapons are celebrated because you learn how to use it. And you become one with that MP5 and you know exactly how much it climbs depending on how much you've pulled the trigger. You know, you know exactly how much range you have with it, how much penetration you have with it. And that's a big difference between that and just hopping into Call of Duty.
And the economy in Counter-Strike is pretty cool too, where it's pretty basic, but like, you know, you don't have people running around first round with the best weapons in the game. You have to kill people and earn money and complete objectives. And then you eventually your team.
So if you like that, then you would probably like World of Tanks.
Okay.
Because there's definitely an element, like I was trying to explain, like World of Tanks is very much like a first-person shooter but played with tanks where the tanks are the people. And the thing about a tank is it can at least usually take a shot or two.
Right.
But it's the exact same thing. It's about knowing your strengths and weaknesses of the vehicle that you have, knowing the landscape of the map that you're in, and where, based off of your capabilities and the map and what the enemy is going to try and do, where you should be and what you can do, and then when things go to shit, which way to get out of it.
See, that's cool. I mean, I wish more games had that sort of like tactical level of I don't want to jump in and be the best person in the game the first time I play.
You won't. And then the thing is it's cool up until you get to just exactly as people warned me. It's cool right up until you get to tier 5. So there's 10 tiers of tanks,
okay,
and you play with a tank to earn experience in that tank, and then you unlock things in its tree. So it has like an RPG skill tree like tech tree,
right.
And you're unlocking pieces of tech for your tank, which then allows you to unlock new tanks or tank destroyers and stuff, and you can move up. And they're graded by tiers. The tiers are mostly based off of eras, and so they get progressively better and better and better.
Right.
And then when you're match made within a tier or two of whatever tier you're in. So if you're like in a tier 3, there might be a tier 2 in the match and a tier 4 or tier 5. Now, but then that's cool because now you have to watch out. Like the tier 5 definitely will smoke you if they catch you.
Now, is the balancing holding up like as you're going through, or are you finding yourself in any matches that are like –
Oh, you find yourself in matches where you're like way overpowered all the time.
Right.
You know, especially if you're like a lower tier tank and you wind up – if you're a lower tier tank, especially in a lower class, because then they're also classed. So you have like light, medium, and heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a lower tier tank, which means you have a older set of tech and you're in a lightweight, which means you probably don't have a lot of armor penetration, you come against something that's heavy and armor plated, you probably could just sit there in front of it and fire shots into it. It's just going to bounce off the front of the thing, right?
Cool.
But you have to know that ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you know what your role is and you know how you can play
the
game.
I love picturing the guy that doesn't know that's like, oh, I got him.
You actually see it. It's really funny. But you see people applying all kinds of and it is sort of Counter-Strike. Like on a, in the low tier, there are some little lightweight tanks that have auto-firing guns, and there are people who load them up and just go racing into enemies and firing away like machine guns out of their tanks. It's bizarre. At the same time, they're risking coming into the midst of an area where there might be a heavier grade tank that with one shot could drop them.
Right.
But they're relying on their speed and their rate of fire to be able to take out other enemies. There's a lot of cool give and take like that, and then the grind of the – well, actually the progression at first that then becomes the grind of leveling up does really – I mean, like I said, it's kept me – it's totally eaten into my nighttime like cooldown watching Justified time.
Right.
Because now I'm like, oh, I'm going to go play because I want to go rack up my bonus experience each day for each of my tanks so I can at least move them forward a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience you need once you get around five, tier five to move up to like next tier, that's where it starts to kick in that, oh, well – you can spend enough time to play, but yeah, if you want to...
Have you dropped any cheddar on it yet?
I have not dropped any cheddar on it yet.
But that, you're close.
I don't think I will, actually, because I don't project that I will. Because I'm having fun, but I think that I'm getting close to the point where I'm going to slow down and just sort of like occasionally go... Because the tanks that I have are fun to play with. Like I finally got my first tier five, and it's the M4 Sherman American Medium Tank, and it's really fun. It's really versatile. There's lots I can do with it. There's lots to level up, and I feel like a sense of accomplishment earning the experience to increase its guns and stuff. But I don't think I really necessarily want to go... And in that tier level, there's a lot of players, and there's a lot of players who get the game but aren't experts. And then every so often, someone who really knows the game will be in a match. You're like, that guy actually knows exactly what they're doing with that tank, and is like, that's why they have six kills. And I don't know that I necessarily want to learn the game that hardcore. I've learned enough to know, like, you know, how to position myself, how to use my armor correctly to bounce shots. Like, that's a big thing. It's like, you could call it bouncing shots. So you, like, position yourself so that when a shot comes in, it hits your armor at an angle such that you get – so, if you know, if the thickness is this far and then you hit it at an angle, it's like the thickness is effectively deeper.
Right.
So
right.
It won't penetrate.
See,
it bounces.
This sounds –
there's lots of cool stuff to it.
It sounds a little bit – or quite a bit deeper than I thought it was on first blow. I'm going to have to give it a shot.
It is arcade-like in driving around and shooting guns at enemies, and it is thoughtful and tactical in that there is actually a good bit of cover and sight rules and
right.
You know, like line of sight matters. And then the way you stay in, because it's pre-digital era, the way you know where your enemies are is visual sighting, and then your tank has a radio. And so each of the tanks in the battlefield has a radio circumference based off how good their radio is.
Right.
And as long as you're within another person's radio circumference and they're within someone else's radio circumference, you're all talking to each other.
I think I remember you saying you can like daisy chain them together.
So you're like, daisy chained around the battlefield.
Right.
So it's really important that someone on your team has a really, really good radio to help keep people tied together. But then if you lose that person, you know, you can at 1 minute know where all of your team is and part of the other team, and then someone is lost, and suddenly because the radio chain's been broken, you're like sitting over here on one side of the map and you can see like the two tanks that are next to you and nothing else.
Wow.
And you're like, oh, shit. Now what?
Right, right.
But it makes great stories. Like last night I was playing a match and I thought we were losing. We were going to get our asses kicked, and it was me and one tank destroyer left. And they thought they had us, and so we sort of split wide on either side of the map and took up high sight lines back into where our base is or where our capture point is. We let them come into the capture point, and then from really good superior firing positions just unloaded on them and took out four enemies. Mm-hmm. And then drove all the way to the other end of the map and captured their base because all they had left was their artillery piece. We just drove on the artillery piece, blew them up, and won the game.
Okay, I'm sold. That sounds – I mean, and it's free, so it's, I'm sold.
Yeah. And the thing is, if you get you captured into it, I think that what they've learned is that like they have a pretty slow drip for making money. Like the first thing they do is buy a premium membership. And the premium membership is the Jetpack Joyride Coin Doubler.
Coin Doubler, yeah.
It's the Coin Doubler, except it works in both. It works. It doubles your experience, and it doubles your coin in-game currency that you earn.
So you haven't purchased that, though?
I haven't needed to purchase it yet,
yeah.
But I can see to go from Tier 5 to Tier 6 in a reasonable amount of time, I would need to, like, purchase – I think the way to do it would be to say, you know what? I'm going to play a lot this week and buy it for a week.
I think I'll probably at least play it till I hit the cheddar wall, and then I'll –
And then keep in mind there's like six tiers – I mean six nations, each of them with like four or five different forks in the trees between artillery, tank destroyers, real tanks, light tanks, medium tanks. Like, so there's a lot to play with for – there's a tremendous amount of stuff to play with for free.
Cool.
So are you like me where I'm pay-averse for a free-to-play game?
I am pretty pay-averse for a free-to-play game.
I think weird because I picture, oh, this could be great and I'll probably have 20 hours of enjoyment out of it. But I don't want to give them any money when I can play for free. And I mean, I feel like it should be the opposite where it's like you hear people talk about it for iOS games where it's a free game and you want to give the developer some money so you'll buy a doubler pack or whatever. But that just doesn't work on me. I'm the opposite. When I get something for free, I just want it all for free.
Honestly, I have the worst – I am the worst egotistical gamer sometimes because now my problem with world – I actually was thinking about – because so I at a couple of E3s, I picked up these little plastic tanks that they give. You know, they always have like the stupid tank out front, and they like give away these plastic tanks. And if you like flip them over on the back of the card, is like a code for 500 gold. So I have like, and gold's like the real money. So I have like 1,000 gold from a couple of tanks, and I was gonna spend it on premium to play, and then like something inside of me clicked, and I was like, yeah, but if I do that, I'm getting like double experience for just buying it. Like, that's not real experience.
Right.
That is so dumb.
Right. Well, it's another way that speaks to how free to play is an anathema to the gaming industry when used that way, because you are designing around a business model as opposed to designing a game. You know what I mean? Like
at the same time, I have a hard time knocking them because they've given away so much freaking game.
Right. And it sounds like they do it a bit better than your average, you know, I mean, pay to win sort of situation.
One game that I'm afraid of about the free to play transition is Plants vs. Zombies 2.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I'm like, I want to play it. And then when it gets to the point where it's like, maybe I have to spend money, I just want to give them $15 to just unlock like
everything.
A proper version of that game. Like that's the way my brain works. Yeah. I really hate microtransactions. But, you know, give me like a lump sum to just buy from the get-go,
so
I'll go for it.
I'm really glad to hear you say that because one of the two games I'm working on right now for mobile is free-to-play and is microtransaction-driven. And don't shake your head. I mean, look, it's free. We give away a lot of game too. And one of the things we decided recently was that we were going to add, in addition to being able to buy this one element of the game piecemeal, a just flat fee, just, you know, you could buy it for like a weekly or monthly amount of time for, you know, pretty cheap. Because we just said, actually, you know what, if they wanted to just buy this for like a week or so, we'd like them to have it for cheap because then they'd actually just be buying something. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I feel like I wonder if it's our age. And I wonder if younger gamers, and I mean like really younger gamers, maybe 10-year-olds, don't have the same reaction to it. Because to us, or to me, I don't want to project on you guys, free-to-play is this new thing that I'm still coming to terms with. And part of my fear is, oh, I don't want to give them money because I'll get down the slippery slope. And before I know it, I've spent $1,000.
It's not that it's new. It's that we're old enough to understand how money works. I mean, seriously.
That's actually a pretty good point.
When you're young enough, it's like, whatever. Like, you know, it's only 49 cents. Like, that's not anything. And like,
buy two routers and return one.
Like, yeah. Or be like Garnett and... But seriously, like, you know, a lot of the younger people that I know, God, that makes me sound old. A lot of the younger people,
the whippersnappers out there.
I've spent a lot of money.
Andrew, repeat after me. Get off my lawn.
Yeah, that's right.
They have no concept. It's like, you know, well, my mom or my dad, you know, they pay for. I think. Until you get to that age where you're really like earning money and you understand that, like
how do you explain then the societal impact? Because, you know, last week at Develop in Brighton, the co-founder of the studio that made CSR Racing, which I think most of these listeners are familiar, but CSR Racing is a free-to-play game on iOS that has made buckets of money. They own one of the McLarens
based on the money, not
as much as Candy Crush Saga, I don't think. But.
No, but CSR has a pretty wicked pay loop in it, where it really gets you. It's also a game that once I legendarily saw the designer talking about how they designed the pay loop first and then put a game on it, which was really irritating to me. Anyway, this guy who's co-founder of the studio said at this developer conference that he fully expects to see within the next few years a free-to-play game that generates $10 million in revenue.
I believe it.
Per day.
Oh, okay. Well.
Per day.
Jeff and I were both on board.
I just threw up on my mouth a little bit there.
Well, there isn't there that that RPG that already makes like millions of dollars a day already?
So there are a number of games that are already reputed to be making $2 to $3 million a day, including Candy Crush Saga is one of them. Puzzles and Dragons, which is super successful in the Asian countries and is actually really I haven't gotten to the paywall yet, but Puzzles and Dragons I play that game every day too. And Puzzles and Dragons is really a pain in the ass because it's another one of these games where like what Candy Crush does, where it's deceptive. You know, at first you're playing the game and you can totally play it for free, and it tricks you into thinking it's a skill game. Right? It's like, oh, right. I can play this. I match these gems. I figure out, oh, I can look three steps ahead and go, oh, if I match this yellow here, then these red will fall, and then the red will fall and hit the blue. But then somewhere into it, by the way, in Candy Crush, it's when you cross the bridge. When you cross the bridge, that's when the game goes from being a skill game to a pay game. Because at that point, even if you're super good at the skill part of it, you're going to need to buy power-ups because now the difficulty has gone from, you know, X to a power of 10,000x.
So is it a gambling addiction type thing? There are so many great games on iOS devices or free-to-play games on across PC, iOS, whatever. Like what stops people then? Is it, one, what Andrew was saying, they don't realize how much they're spending, or B, they're addicted. Like what stops them? I cross the bridge in Candy Crush, and then I delete it, and I go play Plants vs. Zombies 2 for a little bit. Like what?
Nothing. They don't need you. They know that there are going to be enough people out of capturing that.
So that's what I mean. For these people that are giving them tons of money.
Oh, the ones that keep going.
Like what – is it a compulsion? Are they addicts? Is it
– Yeah, it's probably – I mean, I think it's the dopamine feed.
Is it worth it to them? Like I spend money on stupid stuff, but I'm like, these shoes were worth it.
That's two conversations. Is it worth it if you are getting a good sense of – like if you're enjoying it and in whatever reason, even if you're in that like what we would consider weird fantasy land, but if you're in a spot where you're enjoying it and getting a lot of satisfaction out of playing it because you're dumping, you know, $5 a week into it.
And you can afford it. Like you're not – yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Right? Yeah.
It's really not
– I just think most of those games don't – they do a disservice to, you know – gaming
many of them do.
Yeah.
And hopefully there will continue to be more folks who, when they're making those games, really think about designing good games and making, you know, equitable ways to be good partners.
Let's not forget that for a lot of people, the word game doesn't even register as video games. The word game registers as a casino game, as a slot game. So, you know, if anything, these free-to-play titles probably have more in common with
that stuff.
Yeah. And you know what? The $10 million a day game, if it happens, will be that sort of game. It will not be. I mean, look, everyone knows that the backbone of Vegas, the slot machines, those are there to take your money. Mm-hmm. Those are there to take your money, just like evidently the backbone of a lot of free-to-play gaming on mobiles is. It's there to take your money.
Well, and if you break it down to the most basic level, they make slot machine games.
Yeah, they
do. People buy and pay to play, and you can't win anything.
And the great thing about modern casino game design is that they really try to engage the player in such a complicated, maybe sort of different way where, the transaction is still you ultimately pressing a button and pulling a handle.
Right.
But there's so much else going around with that you feel like
there's
a lot
more
agency.
Yeah, so are they having fun? And are they having fun with it? Because, you know, like I've spent – And Ariel as well. We spent hours like in Mad Moxie's, like pumping iridium into the stupid jackpot, the one arm bandit. Well, come on, be like, oh, come on, give me a good weapon.
Now, but take that to the next level where you were actually opening your wallet and pulling out your ATM card, and then like
totally
every,
different.
You know, it's, I don't know. I don't think that model, that economic model, is ultimately a healthy thing for gaming. I think it's a great revenue generator for some people, and it will continue to be that. But
do you think we'll see
like
regulation coming into this, like real government regulation, like the way casino games are?
I think we'll see them looking for tax revenue.
Well, and especially if you run into situations where people are able to play for real money in some ways, or real currency that you can buy with real money, or you know, whatever.
Although they're getting sales tax every time you buy in the iTunes store, so I guess they're making their cut too. Uncle Sam's always gets his.
But in terms, I think what Christian's talking about is like actually regulating.
Where
fundamental design philosophies have to be
like the Nevada Gaming Commission.
Yeah, regulate mature games. That's what you need to worry about. What you need to worry about are addictive.
Now we just
games.
Need to figure out how to do it for Weekend Confirmed, and then all of us can just retire fat, dumb, and happy. I bet you didn't expect the first segment to go like that, but that's because it's summertime. You have no idea what to expect. So go jump in the pool if you're here at the San Diego Comic-Con. Have a great time. Hope you're having a lot of fun. If you stick around here, we will be right back. We've got games we've been catching up on to talk about, your questions and more on this episode of Weekend Confirmed.
Sure, you can pay $60 if you want to play a video game. But what if you want to play all the latest video games? Try Gamefly.com, the number one video game rental service. Right now, you can sign up for just $5.95, their lowest price ever. Gamefly has over 8,000 titles, including the hottest new releases like DMC Devil May Cry, The Walking Dead, and Hitman Absolution. And here's how easy it is. Just sign up, select your games, and Gamefly will ship them directly to your door. You can keep the games as long as you want, there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. Once you're done playing a game, send it back, and Gamefly will send you the next available game on your list. Now, you can also play hundreds of PC games with Gamefly's new Unlimited PC Play, which is free for members. Gamefly also saves you money by letting you try your favorite games before buying them. If you really like the game you're playing, simply click Keep It on the Gamefly website, and it's yours at a deeply discounted price. And if you're still unsure, which you shouldn't be at this point, but if you're still unsure, we're offering our listeners a special offer. This is just for Weekend Confirmers. Go to gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed for an extended 15-day free trial. That's gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed and sign up today.
Pretty funny to hear Jeff Cannata's voice, although apparently not as funny as it is to be at Six Flags, where I guess some Gamefly commercial that I recorded once upon a time is being run at Six Flags.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah,
no way.
It's in the loop. I've heard it a few times before.
Are you the gamer at your house being like, I love playing games?
I was like, no, I'm afraid to go to Six Flags. So I'm going to like walk up and be like, yeah, can I get a coconut? You're that son of a bitch that we have to fucking listen to. I'm like, I'm sorry, okay? It's not me. I'm sorry. It's not. What are you talking about? I have no idea. All right, Mr. and Mrs. Video Gamer across the world. Breaking news. We have the June NPD figures. They're pretty exciting.
Well, I mean, they're not exciting.
They're thrilling.
They're very predictable.
That's why I had to give them like the breaking.
No, they're not predictable.
Breaking news.
The 3DS is on top. So apparently, if you release lots of good games for a console, people buy that console.
Who knew?
Huh.
So really, Nintendo could probably learn a lesson from the 3DS.
From Nintendo?
Yeah.
Nintendo could really learn a lesson to Nintendo.
Well,
need Jerome to run up with the mirror.
That's what they're hoping they'll do with Wii U. But this Animal Crossing game did really well. Last of Us did really well. But I think the big surprise, Minecraft for Xbox 360. Now, you might be wondering, hey, but you know, Minecraft, how can it get on
there? We don't do digital.
So wait,
we don't do digital on NPD.
We're top three. Because I think it got a little confusing. We're talking about 3DS, and then you said Animal Crossing, and then Last of Us.
Last of Us, I think, was number one, Animal Crossing number two, and Minecraft number three.
You're so 3DS
right.
was top You're hardware.
I'm gonna have to double check that, but that involves reaching into my pocket for my phone, and I don't really want to bother doing
Those
that.
Jeans
right
are tight.
Just like I can't be asked to do that. You know what? Screw it. It's really not that exciting. June, the numbers are pretty bad overall anyway. They're
but I interrupted right before the exciting part though, because three is exciting.
Yeah, Minecraft. I mean, so the reason why I think that's exciting is that it's the retail version. They released a retail version of Minecraft. They put it on a disc mm-hmm. that you could buy in a store, and apparently, lots of people still like buying content on a disc and putting it in their machines.
Or are a lot of people's machines not connected? Like, I feel like what does that potentially say about the original vision for the Xbox One? This game was available for so – you're just so adverse to putting your credit card out there, buy a points card. You're so – you mm-hmm. don't have it hooked up. You want your parents buy this for kids, but it's not a major holiday.
Well,
gift giving season.
And some of it's probably like, hey, Mom, can I get Minecraft? And she's like, what's that? Oh, it's on Xbox. What's it on Xbox? Like, I can't go to the store and buy it? I mean, like, I think that was probably a lot of it, too.
I think there's, so many hurdles in order to get that. For people that listen to this show, it's so easy. You just go to Xbox Live Marketplace and you just drop, 1,600 right. Microsoft points. But for a lot of people, that's still something that they have no real concept of, and they've probably heard of this nebulous cool thing that all the kids are playing called Minecraft.
I feel like the kid that, you're at school and all your friends are talking about it. It must suck to be the kid that has an Xbox that's hooked up to the internet but can't get it. Like that, your parents are like, no, we're not going to let you do that. You're going to wait for the box edition to come out.
Well, you're probably already playing it on your phone and you're playing it maybe on a PC somewhere. And I think this is just another, I don't know that.
And I'm not trying to disparage the game.
No,
great game. Kudos to Notch and everybody. Like, fantastic.
I'd be curious to find out what the most played version of that game is. Like what device?
Oh, it's got to be PC. Come on. It's got to still be PC.
I don't know, man. A lot of kids are playing that on their
phones. I know, but still
and stuff.
millions of people playing on. By the way, I reached in my pocket, get my phone out, so we could have Liam Callahan of the NPD's analysis. Some great ones here to put it just as you did.
Just as Yoon did?
Just as Yoon did. What did he say? Let's quote. He had this quote about software. To quote Nintendo during E3, software sells hardware, which is evident in the month's 3DS results. Strong double-digit increases in the 3DS hardware sales were coupled with triple-digit increases in software. Holy cow, people like Animal Crossing.
And I'm curious because I think Animal Crossing is also available on the eShop. So
it is. It is indeed.
If it's doing that well at retail, I do wonder how well it's been doing on digital. Same thing with Last of Us as well.
I think that you can make that argument on any platform other than Nintendo, but the eShop is just not that great of a shopping experience. And how many people even think about – how many people have a 3DS and think about buying stuff for it digitally?
Well, Fire Emblem, I can't say it, did really
for
well. Farm Emblem. It's about farming emblems.
Oh, excellent.
Fire Emblem did really well.
Someone is out there right now furiously seeing if they can trademark that. They're like, wait, shit.
Farm Emblem.
It's going to be the $10 million
game.
That's
right.
I think some people are aware of it. I feel like Last of Us maybe probably has an even smaller number of digital downloads. It's such a big download.
It is a big download.
But,
well, and Last of Us did really great. The Last of Us was the top-selling game at retail in the month of June. To put this in context, it had the second highest first month sales of a PS3 first-party game after God of War 3, which was back in March of 2010. It was also the third highest game to launch during the month of June since NBD began tracking sales in 1995.
And it's the only thing to play until mid-August.
Well, you can go back and play it a few times.
No, I know. Yeah, that's true.
Apparently, it has multiplayer. It's just like Counter-Strike.
Yep, apparently.
There is a multiplayer mode. You should try it.
I want to. I completely forget about that.
And your random fun summer fact. This is the first time since this console generation began that the top three games that sold through retail were first-party platform exclusives, each from a different first party. In this case, it was Last of Us, Animal Crossing New Leaf, and Minecraft. So there you go.
Yeah, so, Minecraft is kind of a wink fitting into that category.
Well, for this console generation.
Microsoft owns that on console, even on Xbox One. I mean, that was their big indie surprise for E3, so...
Yeah. Shocking.
Pretty big surprise.
This just in. We're going to stick with that Minecraft thing. I hear it's pretty popular. Oh, and you know what makes me sad and baby Jesus cry is that Black Ops 2 was number 4.
I have a little side note on that. I just started playing that. I swore I would never pay money to play it because of the Oliver North thing. And I started playing it through Gamefly because, you know.
Because it's the number one destination for video games?
That's right. Yeah. So you can rent it and...
Hey,
kid, get in the back of my van. There's a lot of cool games back here.
I was really nonplussed.
I'm playing through the campaign. I'm really nonplussed by that game. I don't want to slam it. It's because I'm not talking about the multiplayer and stuff, but I'm just like, oh, I'll go through the campaign or whatever. And it's like, just press forward and, you know, click left trigger a bunch of times. And
that's why you have to
slam away. No one cares.
You have to rig your queue, though, so that you always get the game at the top of your queue. I don't know how far down is Black Ops. You got to keep that stuff fresh. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's true. That's probably. Yeah.
I don't even have this on my queue. Someone adds it for you. Like, no.
I was hoping I'd get Sly Cooper or something.
Sadly, I guess Deadpool was sort of left to die also. I feel bad for High Moon. So it was a great studio, and that was sort of their.
I mean, I'm assuming that studio is closed now and that the reports are going to come out any day now.
Any day, yeah.
Probably Saturday at Comic-Con. They'll just like whoosh,
they're gonna have a panel announcing.
No, I think it would be lost in the news. They would just.
That's a really bad feeling. Actually, though, on a subject of news, something that Andrew brought up to me about Comic-Con, which is really freaking hilarious, is this Tekken Revolution story. So Tekken Revolution, free to play PS3 fighting game, already released. Andrew and I were actually talking about it. I said, wait, did that game come out? He's like, yeah, it came out during E3. Genius move there. Namco Bandai once again demonstrating their impeccable timing. Way to go, guys. Apparently, they ran a little thing. So Evo was last weekend, and did it start during Evo, or were they finishing up this contest during Evo?
They just threw out this poll on their Facebook site during Evo. They asked, so they're apparently going to add a new character to Tekken Revolution, but the choices are
amazing. They're amazing. I want to give you – so they started this fan vote, and they got it down to 10 for you to vote for which fan favorite to add. They've already narrowed it down. Voting's closed. They're gonna reveal the top three at their panel during San Diego Comic-Con, and this might be incentive to go because here's the 10 you're choosing from. The first one was sexy female Tekken Force character. So sexy female Tekken Force character was actually going to be in Tekken 5, but the clothing was a little too revealing, so they decided they might get bumped on the ESRB rating and decide, well, we're going to pull it. No, we don't want
to
risk
that. Wait, do we even need to read the rest of the list?
No. I mean, oh yes, we do.
Okay.
Because the next one is Sayaka.
No.
Sake.
Yes, there you go.
But they spelled Sayaka for
you
Americans.
Well, no, so the they're doing the she with the yo character.
Oh, that's what they're doing. Yeah. Ah, I should have figured that out. There's sake, which is salmon, and it's a fish. No, I mean, it's really literally, like think fish. Like press the punch button and the fish will flop around. Press the kick button and the salmon will, of course, put out salmon eggs.
Of course. Of course, because that's the special move.
And the amazing thing about that was that character was actually considered for an earlier version of Tekken.
Tekken 3 Arcade. It was actually in the Tekken 3 Arcade ROM as a placeholder, like they were ready to put it in there.
But, press circle to produce row.
But apparently, it's hard to balance a fighting game when a character is a salmon.
Well, look. All I have to say is,
truer words never been spoken.
If Sega could pull off a NASCAR that punched with its tires, I have faith that Namco can pull off a fish that squirts out eggs and flops around.
I mean, this is the franchise that has a kangaroo as a playable character.
It's true.
And Bob.
Well, yeah.
Character 3 is simply female vampire.
Of course.
And then it sounded pretty predictable. It was like, oh, it's like fights, and then it also has like some fireball moves like a 2D player. So, it's okay. Nothing's too special there.
Number 4 is Tim Tebow. They let the fans vote for anything.
Oh, my God. Well, actually, it's Shin Kamiya, who's a classmate of Jin. But get to this. So there was the anime Blood Vengeance, and apparently this guy died in there. So they're worried about how they would keep the fiction clean. Because they're worried about how do you
right.
keep the fiction
sure,
clean
stories,
in a fighting
yeah.
game. But then the other thing is that he doesn't know martial arts.
Oh.
So
what does he know? He knows the Scottish martial art. Fuck you.
He knows crazy.
Yeah. It's like headbutting people.
Apparently there's another character named Tugu, and he does the same thing. Don't know anything about him. He died in Tekken 6, though. He was like a part of the Force Mode characters. Then the next one was Zombie Bride. And then I put zombie for the next one, but it wasn't zombie. It's female Paul, which they described as Paul.
RuPaul, perhaps?
Paul inexplicably turned into a girl, but a very cute girl.
A very cute girl.
They were explicit about her, about him, him, her being a very cute girl.
He has the cheek structure for it, though.
What I was wondering is, like, which way do they go? I mean, do they make it look like Paul, but, like, in drag? Or is it like they actually make a whole new
character? Don't know how you're feeling when you're playing that character? Neither do we.
it'll be the poison of the
franchise. Yeah, like, it's a new experience. The next one was Giant Praying Mantis, which came about during...
My favorite so far.
Yeah, Giant Praying Mantis, which was the bug, and it was a bug that got them thinking about it. Evidently, during development, there was a version where the character models weren't working right and their arms would flip backwards. And they decided it looks like Praying Mantis. So there you go. It's a bug. It's a bug character that came from a bug.
Bite your head off after it mates with you.
The upcoming one is my favorite
this
one.
This is your favorite one. Andrew's favorite one. Average run-of-the-mill old man.
Where are my pills?
They describe this as every neighborhood has one.
He just dies immediately.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, no, they're explicit. Like, he does not know martial arts either.
No, he just screams a lot of racist epithets at you and... I don't know.
Totally bizarre. And then finally, the teenage female sumo wrestler, Ganmi-chan. So the top three from your votes on Facebook will be revealed at the San Diego Comic-Con panel. And then they're going to let the audience somehow – what's going to happen is whichever one of these is the absolute absurdest of them.
That's salmon.
The panel – well, we're all pulling for the salmon.
Yeah,
I think we're all secretly pulling for the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
No? Christian, what are you pulling for?
I just feel like Ashton Kutcher runs out at the panel and is just like, I'm back, bitches, and you got pumped.
It's like a giant fighting game. You got punked.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Okay. I take that back. This makes me feel good because it feels like as much as gaming has changed, gaming hasn't changed. Because it was stupid when they first had like the kangaroo and Bob and all this crap, and then you were on Street Fighter 2 version 14. Like, we have Ultra Street Fighter 4 coming out. We've got crazy shit back in Tekken. Like, the good times are here to stay.
Just roll, brother.
In fact, I want a fighting game where it's just like salmon versus, you know, wallaby versus...
You should play Dive Kick. I don't know if you had a chance to try it.
No.
Dive Kick is an upcoming fighting game for PS3 and Vita and eventually PC. The gimmick of Dive Kick is that it's a two-button fighter.
Oh, Dive Kick, I assume, is your primary move.
So
it's your only move.
You can only dive and kick. There's no movement buttons either.
Yeah.
So dive lets you just jump in the air, and kick makes you dive kick.
Right.
That's one-hit kill.
And it's one-hit kills.
What?
And
it's awesome.
It is so incredible. I know it sounds dumb.
No, it sounds ridiculous. Not dumb, ridiculous, but ridiculous in an awesome way.
But it really does distill the fighting game to just the most pure, amazing amount of fun you could possibly have.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think it's going to be cross-buy for...
It's cross-buy on PlayStation Network, and they're also making a PC version. And they even made a special controller, which is just two giant buttons.
Yeah, and then the sequel's Roll Punch. That's the second...
It's being developed by one of the guys at...
Sweep him with a leg?
I think the EIC of that is the consultant or designer of that game. So
I mean, I feel like... I think it's been said online before, but I mean, I think it almost started as a joke, but it's getting such good traction. Like, at PAX, it was packed, and everybody's really excited about it, and characters now have different jumps, and so there's strategy.
There's actually a lot of depth to this two-button fighter because each of the characters jumps completely differently.
It's like Chicken. It's a distilled-down fighting game, but it is a lot like Chicken. Like, who's going to blink first, and who's going to mess up, and you lose, and it's... intense for you're just literally sitting there doing nothing or just like
looking. All right,
yeah.
And at Evo they actually had some pretty masterful players showing off Dive Kick, and it is completely different just seeing all these people flying up in the air, like canceling their kicks, and they're like diving again, and it looked like Crouching Tiger sort of. You know, just all these people just flying in the air. It's amazing. I
feel like they captured what Capcom's been trying to with, like, you know, the touch screen on the 3DS for Super Street Fighter 4. Like, we've made special moves simpler and accessible for everybody. And Dive Kick's just like, we've made it accessible for everybody. It's all just two buttons.
In fact, that's all you can do is a special move.
Yeah, you have a move.
You have a move.
A move.
But you don't have a singular salmon.
All right,
no,
so let's...
Yeah, I want that fighting game.
Getting back into the summer swing, I think everyone felt like summer for gamers also had another big moment in the last week with the Steam summer sale. How bad's it been? What's the damage so far up in here?
$10 for Dishonored.
Okay.
But I feel like Steam sale this year has shown how good of a value PS Plus is. I know with Steam you get to keep your game, and with PS Plus,
really,
it goes
away. So do you like walk to work or do you carry your lunch?
I work at home because my wife still supports me.
Wait, I mean, what do you mean about like Steam sale has shown the value of PS Plus? Explain that a little bit.
I was going to pull a trigger on XCOM until I remembered I already had it.
Okay.
Saints Row 3, already have it. Like a lot of these games that are on sale, Sleeping Dogs, so I
ran in that same thing. But then the counterpoint was, hey, Garnet, Sleeping Dogs on PS3 is fine, but for $6.25, it's better on PC.
Well, there's an actual full-on HD graphics patch that you can install PC.
If you're trying to be a cheap ass,
yes,
yeah,
which
true.
Is the point of
that is the point,
the Steam
true.
Sale or being a PlayStation Plus member. It's still cheaper to be on PlayStation
or
Plus.
It's nice to see these deals, this type of stuff coming to console gamers. PlayStation, I forget what this last sale was called, but if you were a Plus subscriber, they had, you know, games for Steam sale type prices that you could actually own.
And their upcoming promo, PlayStation Store Play.
Yeah, for
annual.
For DuckTales and three
other
games.
Pretty good prices.
Yeah, I think it's like, it ends up being like $24 for all of those games or something like that if you're on.
But on the flip side, I don't think you can get either Euro Truck Simulator 2 or Farming Simulator 2013.
Farm Simulator's on Vita.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's on Vita.
Oh, cool.
It's coming out on a PS.
I like how he said that so earnestly, too. He's like, Farm Simulator's on Vita, dude.
Yeah, and it's coming out on PS3 and 360 later this year.
Well,
which means it'll be on PS Plus a month after that.
There we go.
Makes sense.
But
makes sense.
The Steam sale's great, and there's a lot of fantastic stuff. There was, I don't know the article, but just saying the psychology of the Steam sale and how the sales are already plotted out, but yep. giving you choice through a community sale makes you more inclined to buy it because you think you picked it. And like, now I got to get this. Like, I was so pissed when Dishonored didn't win community choice. And I was like, I would have bought it for $10. And sure enough, when it showed up as a daily deal 2 days later for $10, I was like, yep. Nice try, Steam.
I got you, bitch. I spent that money. I'm spending it right now. So actually, it's one. By the way, you guys out there, listeners and gals, obviously, to be specific like that, did an excellent job. I was really, you know, we talked about doing questions, and I was like, you know, every time we do questions, it seems sort of run out of steam, and then people show up, and the questions. Holy shit, you guys nailed it this week. The questions, yeah. If the questions are as good as they were on the show thread from last week, we'll keep doing that as long as you want to. You guys were on top of it. So first one I'm going to throw in here is from Shanafan XBL. And it's right into our Steam summer sale topic. So it's great. There's a lot of incredible deals on headliner games. But isn't the excitement of buying a game also involved with the idea of owning it, which you put in quotes? Having a nice boxed copy of the title, displaying it on the shelf, and having a great physical collection. Does looking at a populated list of titles in Steam have the same feel?
Yes. Actually, it's better because when I was in Korea a month or so ago, I booted up Steam. I showed my cousins. Oh, look, here are the like 600 games that I'm never going to play. But I own them, bitches. And I was very proud. I couldn't lug my 600 game collection internationally. You can't brag.
But does Minecraft Box Edition say hello?
That's good. That's exactly the point. I mean, that's exactly the point right now. Is here, Minecraft has been available digitally on everything under the sun, and then suddenly they put it out in a box copy for 360 and people gobble it up.
Look, if you can sell me a game that was previously $60 when it first came out and maybe now 50 or $40 for $5 or $10, you know, that's a lot you're paying for the box at that point, like to make that decision to go, oh, yeah, I really want the physical media. And it's sometimes you're just like, no, I'd rather play the game for $5.
Well, I love physical media and I love owning physical media. But I think the question is, like, does having a large digital library, have that same kind of impact that having a large physical library does? I think increasingly, yes. I think it also sort of ties into my desire for a high gamer score or a high trophy score.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
Where I just want that number to get bigger regardless of what the actual quality of the, number is.
What's your games unplayed number, bro? Oh, dude, 400. Oh, man, I'm only at 399.
Exactly.
Yeah, where's my badge for that?
Like, oh, you know, there actually is a backlog game website. I used to look at it kind of frequently. I decided I didn't really sign up for it because it would just make me feel more shamed. But he's like, literally, you can log into it. You could create like your profile and put in the games that you haven't played that you want to play and like clock out the amount of time it would take. It like tracks all this stuff. It's kind of cool site. Someone will know what it is and it'll be in the show notes. We'll figure that out. So Andrew says, yeah, he was totally into sharing it, that being able to travel with it. Jeff, you're sort of, I wasn't sure. You seem like you're both.
See, I used to love, I collected DVDs, collect movies and stuff. And I've gotten to the point now where I'm like, as long as I have what seems like perpetual access to those, you know, until I tire of having access, I'm okay with not having the physical media.
Well, what do you think about this? How about as we continue to sort of forage our way into the ever online virtuality of our social world and all of the things that we do in the world, representations of that collection. And I think that's what Steam really gets. And so, you know, Andrew talked about showing it when he went over in Korea because he can show it. You can show like this cool collection of games. And I think, you know, they have those game pages, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Steam, you know, in the next year or so significantly update the way the library and the library interaction works.
Well, and how you can share that information with other people too, right? Like, here, I'm going to hit a button. I'm going to send you my game library without having to, you know,
well, and have
or
places,
I can have you my friends.
And have ways to show it off in different spaces, like whether it be on Facebook or Twitter or wherever it might be, you know, like build your own, like maybe even, you know, simple Tumblr plugins so that you could have like this really cool, like, oh, here's my game collection and I keep it in a regular spot online. And you know, that even comes even more outward facing.
Well, I think the trading cards are another sort of
trading cards are a big
in that
part
vein.
Of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, although the selling part of it is crazy.
I do wonder if Microsoft had any idea about making a representation of your digital library for Xbox One, considering the original vision of that was to have your library,
all virtual,
mobile,
right.
and go with you.
I mean, I think people have tried, but it's coming up with a unique way that works on mobile, right? And this is where now that what's his name, John Ivey. At Apple has taken over design with iOS 7 is looking less like realistic things. But Apple, when like iBookstore came out, They had it so you could – it looked like your book was on a shelf.
It's pretty smart.
See, I think that's kind of stupid. Because
really?
I don't want it to look like that.
I don't want the notepad app to be freaking yellow.
Okay, it doesn't need to do that.
Comic Sans.
But the idea of virtualizing my collection in some way is
and
cool.
And doing it in a way, yeah, that works well on that machine.
Like, remember the thing God.
You're going to talk about the video game cabinet thing?
No, well, I'm going to talk about the PS3 trophy room deal. Remember they talked about like they would have three-dimensional representations of home for your catalog, and you'd have your trophies on display in your trophy room. Okay, now obviously that feels out of date now because it's very virtual world, very like home 1.0. But something where we have that, I think, has a lot of appeal. I've changed. I have a big collection of old games, and every time I look at them now, I sort of start thinking in my mind, okay, which ones of these can I actually start getting rid of? How many of these do I really need to keep anymore? Because I don't have any longer that attachment to it. And you know what? I mean, that's why we see these ever increasingly expensive collector's editions, because I think a lot of publishers realize they're going to sell boxed games that they need to be special. Like, what's the new? Andrew, you were saying you watch the Ubisoft ones, and they creep up like $5 or $10 every time.
Yeah, so Assassin's Creed 4 is $130. Assassin's Creed 3 was $120 for the special edition. Assassin's Creed Revelations and Brotherhood were $100 each. So they're just inching up ever so slightly. And I don't even know if they really add that much more content to the box. Just, the price is just getting a bit higher.
It's
higher.
It's embroidered black flag, dude. Embroidered flag of, you know, Assassin's
Creed. I mean, those statues are really cool. So.
Statues are pretty cool.
Little flask of grog.
Speaking on the special editions, the frustrating thing about special editions for me is, okay, so they have a $130 Watch Dogs special edition, which looks pretty cool, but the game is of a unknown quality, right?
Right.
But the only way you can really get it is by pre-ordering that.
You don't pre-order it, it's gone, yeah. Unless it's the Halo Cat helmet.
Yeah, which they clearly made too many of, but...
Just like the RT tablet.
The frustrating thing about that is... If I'm really passionate about a game, then I want to get that stuff after the fact, and there's actually no market for that.
Right. It's an eBay market. But so that, it's the same
thing with DLC packages, right? They're like, hey, buy the season pass of DLC, single player, multiplayer, whatever, but you have no idea what like 90% of it's going to be, and most of the time you're like,
But I think it's easier to buy a season pass after a game comes out because you're like, oh, well, I want more of that game. But to commit yourself to that kind of money before a game even
very
comes
few developers out, that warrant that sort of.
When does that stuff cut off, though? Let's say, you know, Watch Dogs review. It's, what, 2014 game? So, I mean, will pre-orders, we still be able to get that after reviews come out? Like, how early do you need to get your pre-order in? Is it like, was it BioWare that did it? Was it? I think it was a Star Wars where you know you pre-ordered. The earlier you pre-ordered, the earlier you got access. I mean, is this AC4 and the Watch Dogs things limited like that? Where if you don't get in it before this certain date,
no, it's not limited in that. It's limited in just the
it's
physical
production run.
Quantity of it, and there are enough people that are passionate about those franchises that they'll buy that stuff. But for me, I'm like, well, you know, I want to buy that stuff after the fact. I want to make sure that if I'm going to have a statue of a video game character in my room that I actually enjoyed that game, it's going to be
It's my pile of shame.
Yeah,
statue.
How horrible would it be if you spend $150 and the game ends up being shit, you know? Then you just
have this statue. You got this awesome resin character statue of the four guys from Fuse.
Yeah. And most people I bet that only happens once. And then you have a come to Jesus meeting about what am I buying? Like, why did I just spend double the retail price for?
If they offered those statues after the games come out, I would totally buy them. I would totally buy a Last of Us, you know, special edition.
You'd be all about the Resident Evil 6 characters.
But think about it. They did have a Last of Us collector's edition, which I think also included statues and whatnot.
Well, you know, they probably couldn't get Ellen Page's sign-off on that after
how much
that
would
down.
It be for you to buy it secondhand? I mean, because obviously this stuff is working because you're afraid of not wanting to wait because it's going to sell out. So the publisher, it makes total sense for them to do this and have a true collector's item.
Oh, it makes total sense for them because they're banking it up front.
Right. And if you like it well enough, like, I mean, how much does one of those statues go? Because now you know you love the game. You're vested in it. You know, is it worth $200? You end up paying $50 more than you would have up front, but now you know something you like.
I mean, look at how well Square does with Square goods. I mean, Square goods are super popular. Every year at TGS, if you go on the last day, half the booth is sold out. They do a big business both online and in their shops in Japan. So, I mean, Square gets it. They understand how to come at it.
And I got a San Diego Comic-Con exclusive Snake. That's a Square character.
They also do other toy lines, but I meant specifically for their games. You know, and then they continue to do that. They continue to follow up afterwards with new arts, and that's sensible.
Right, and that's what I think they should do. They have the special edition, but then why not release a different
edition, right? Yeah. A different special edition, and then a collector is going to want maybe both of them, or understand, or like, that's cool. That's the pre-release collector's edition. That's pretty cool. I like that. I think the other thing that's really changed my mind a lot about buying and saving games is this is the second generation now where, well, for last generation, there was at least some lip service to backward compatibility. But this time it's just like backward. Yeah, no, yeah, get no. out of here, kid.
Yep.
There's no backward compatibility. So, save that shit all you want to. But it's the same thing as if you have like a VHS collection or a Laserdisc collection. Unless you've got the player, you're shit out of luck.
Yeah.
And how many times do you actually get that stuff back out? I mean,
going over to James Stevenson's house makes me wish I had all that shit. Right, like that's right. You don't want to, and then you see it, and you're like, "Oh my god, I want it so bad."
I will occasionally open up.
I mean, he keeps his Laserdisc collection right next to his Fuse statues.
I build him up, and you just take his knees right out from under him. Looks like someone's not going over to his house again anytime soon, Andrew.
God. I lost my train of thought. Yeah, with the backward compatibility going away, I think that just definitely changed the equation. And sure. I mean, if you have the opportunity to set up a cool gaming space and you want to do that and you're cool about your classic games, then you'll keep some. Like, I'm not going to let go of my Dreamcast and my Dreamcast games. They're like, I love them too much. I'm too into that. Yeah. And I'm probably never going to let go of my PS1 and some PS1 games and my PS2. Well, the PS2 teeters in a weird spot because I still have my launch day PS3, and so I feel safe-ish there. But the PS2 is not that hard to keep. But then, like, I don't have an Xbox anymore. I don't have an original Xbox anymore. I don't have that thing. I like got rid of it because there wasn't any.
Yeah,
there wasn't any big connection to having it. And so
you didn't want to play the Warriors again, man. Come on,
it's available on PS2 also.
It is now.
So keeping the boxed copies of stuff really starts to lose value, and then conversely, having a digital copy that at least I hold out some hope that I might be able to play through some sort of service is cool. But then the counter argument right there is, well, if they don't support it on, if 360 games that you bought on Xbox Live don't work on Xbox One Live, which they've already said they're not going to, right? Then what the hell is the purpose of buying it digitally either?
Yeah. Steam has the benefit.
Damn it.
There's a lot of stuff on Steam that's like, runs just fine and it's super old, and they do a good job of, updating that stuff so that it's, you don't ever feel like, oh, now I can't play this anymore.
PC suckas.
Yeah.
PC. Word. All right, we'll take a middle of the show break. We got we have some awesome music coming up for you. We've got your questions, and we'll talk about the stuff that we've been catching up on when Week in Confirmed continues. This episode of Week in Confirmed is brought to you by the GameFly app, the must-have app for gamers with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get up-to-the-minute gaming news along with thousands of HD videos and screenshots. Get into the action by creating your own profile, post updates about what you're playing, and stay connected with friends and other gamers. Tired of standing in lines? Find great deals on new and used games, pre-order upcoming titles, and get GameFly's daily deals all from the palm of your hand. If you're already a GameFly member, manage your game queue on the go and keep games you like with just one tap. Get the GameFly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. All right. We have Ozzy, by the way, manning the production duties for us in the booth, doing an awesome job while Del Rio is off doing a little vacation. And he just let us know that there's a new Strider HD announced at Comic-Con. So that's exciting
stuff.
Pretty
awesome, yeah.
I'm sorry. I picture that promo being the one that's played at Six Flags.
I was like, also having that
tired
thought.
Of waiting in lines.
Like, you bastard. God, of course I am. I'm going to kill that guy if I ever see him. All right, let's talk about some games. Jeff, by the way, did you actually say that you bought Euro Truck Simulator?
Farming Simulator 2013.
Why?
Well, okay.
I don't understand. So okay. Those are games. Let me preface this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hand you the mic, but I want to preface it with saying those are the games that you hear about and you're like, yeah, that's a joke, right? But then it's not a joke and you're like, is it really Like you're driving around in a truck
in Europe.
Okay,
in Europe.
so you're describing my pretty much my exact thought process when I was, and this happened over the span of a few days. And the Steam summer sale certainly helped me with both of them being minimum 50% off at any given
okay.
point. And yeah, it was sort of those. I'm not a huge sim guy generally. Like I don't really go in for that. Like you know. Sort of thing, I guess. Like, you know, my dad played a lot of Flight Simulator when I was young, and I was always like, man, snooze fest, like whatever, you know, what are you doing? And so I was sort of, I don't know if it was morbid curiosity, partly boredom, partly just, you know, reading some press and going, oh, these actually sound like they could be kind of interesting. And I will say that I'm really looking forward to, you know, after the show, getting home and then taking a pallet of, you know, forklifts from Edinburgh to Glasgow or from –
it's going to crack open a cold one.
Yeah. And – oh, okay. And here's one of my favorite parts of the game. Before we get into all the nitty-gritty or whatever or as much nitty-gritty as we want, it has a streaming radio station thing in it, which is fucking awesome. It is basically like
– but is it really streaming?
Yeah. Dozens and dozens and dozens of European radio stations.
Oh, shit. Now Vern is going to play.
All over the place. All over the –
well, actually, the question I have, is it tuned to wherever you're driving? So
No. You can go in and basically select whatever radio.
For a simulator, yeah. I feel like that's a pretty big oversight.
No, dude, actually. It's 2013, man. These guys are all got iPods.
Yeah, they have sat radios.
Fair point. But it's – like I've been listening to the Oxford version of Jack FM. And – it is really cool because there's a lot of – Jack FM is like the – I don't know if you're not familiar with it. It's basically the radio station that plays a lot of, you know, 60s through 90s rock and roll, popular stuff. You know, if you were a kid of the 80s.
Music still made with instruments.
Yes.
And I think with no DJs, which is funny. It's music made by played by instruments, but I think it's all a computer-run station.
Well, they still have a – this sounds like it's a little less automated. Like they have the Jack announcer guy, but then they also have – I guess they have a morning show that they do.
Is this the European one?
This is the European one. They have a morning show that they do and like – and you're listening to like
– it's actually a Jacques radio.
Yeah, Jacques FM.
That made me laugh harder than it should have.
The amount of ambience that it adds to the experience is –
you're familiar with your own humor, really obviously.
Cool. Yeah, right. So what do you – so we joked again off before the show about the Sega CD – Penn and Teller game,
the bus
tour or whatever. I mean, what's the game of this?
Okay.
Like, what's the game? It's a sim game.
Yeah. So you start out and you're basically, you don't have your own truck. So you're a truck driver for hire, basically. And what you do is it gives you a roster of.
Do you arm wrestle to get money to buy your truck?
No, no. That's the sequel. Over the top sequel. Yeah.
Do you get an orangutan to ride along with you?
Yeah. BJ and the. Well,
if
anyway,
it seems
bear.
Like we're not taking this game seriously, it's because I'm not taking it seriously.
No, no kidding.
That's fine. That's fine. It's. I got to tell you though. I was.
So you start off with this list.
See, I'm laughing at myself hearing me describe this, but
you start off with this list of contracts.
Yeah,
that you can accept.
Contracts. So you're right? You know, different weights, different trucks. You also pick a brand of truck.
So you'd be like in a box truck or you'd be like with a 40-foot float and you got to decide like what you want to carry.
Well, there's a bunch
Christian
of,
just shot me and looked like, who are you? What happened?
I see. I know fuck all about truck brands and truck models, but they apparently have all these authentic models and you pick your favorite. And then the first showroom that opens, and I don't think you can buy your own truck until you've amassed like, you know, close to 80,000 pounds or something like that. You're basically doing this RPG thing where you're picking a job. And it tells you all the specs on it, whatever, what your cargo is. You get to your destination and you get a payout. And then, of course, on the way, if you get caught in a speed trap or you crash into another vehicle or you know, there's all these things that can happen, you get deducted from the amount you get paid.
Are you literally driving a virtual truck?
You are like, literally driving a virtual truck.
Have they modeled all of Europe?
It's a condensed version. But for example, the mission that I just drove before I came in here today was, you know, I'm not that far. I haven't bought my own truck yet, but I'm getting close. I'm like level 6. I think level 10 or 12 is when you can, you know, really buy your first thing. And it's like a 20.
Does it have truck vista view?
So are you like sitting there on the M5 for like 2 hours driving along?
No. The longest journey that I've done right to this point has been like 20 minutes, 25 minutes. So it's enough that you feel – you get that sort of like I'm on the road, you know, okay, I'm on the freeway. I can relax a little bit and then you're like, oh shit, somebody's coming up on me. So there's this – it does generate this sort of very realistic sense of I'm driving a massive machine down the freeway and
– Breaker, breaker, I'm girl not, with the low-cut dress coming up. Breaker, breaker,
I'm not agile. You know, I'm not like – I really have to plan. Like if I have to watch my GPS to make sure that I don't miss an off-ramp, if I have to turn around, I'm fucked because, you know, I just don't have the real estate or the space to do it.
Have you used the word lorry yet?
No.
Oh.
Only to myself. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I do – I do.
You know what you should do, though, for fun is you should go find the episode of Top Gear where they did the three truck races, which is
–
I won't spoil it for you, but it's ridiculous.
So I guess one of the
it's
big,
Top Gear.
One of the big things about this is like, you know, buying your own trucks and your own fleet of trucks and hiring other drivers.
So I take it you haven't bought a truck yet.
No. I'm getting to that point. I've driven probably – I'm approaching the 10-mission mark. And it's definitely the missions are fun and they're rewarding when you complete them, but they're definitely taxing enough that it's not something you're going to sit and play for like 3 hours in a row.
So are you driving like small trucks? Are you driving like 18-wheel monsters?
12-speed at this point, 12-speed big flatbeds. Sometimes they're, you know.
So you're like driving full-on truck trucks?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can look back and see your cargo and it's like, you know, there's an RPG element. So you start off only being able to deliver basic stuff, but you level up and then you can say, oh, I want to be able to, you know, deliver hazardous gases or you know, flammable materials.
Have to get, like, special licenses?
Yeah, you basically upgrade via a tree. So you go like, oh, I want to be able to drive further, be more fuel efficient, or I want to be able to drive longer distance, get missions that are longer distances. There's a thing even apparently when you get to a certain point, which I haven't experienced yet. I haven't had to refuel because I'm driving for other companies, but there are refueling stops. There are also rest stops. So I assume you eventually get to the point where, you know, there's a little meter that tells you how tired you are, and eventually it'll get to the point where you actually have to find a place to pull over. And
that's where the game gets really exciting because now you're just.
Well, I mean, see, I'm still going to make a lot of fun of this game because it sounds really stupid. But
you're going to go home and buy it.
No, well, it's weird, right? Like, why does the wrapper make me write off a game? Because why am I like?
Because
you know,
it's not a fantasy that you want to live out.
I don't want to go collect 100 herbits or whatever either. But it's like, oh yeah, well then I'm going to kill a dragon. Maybe that's the appeal. Is like the bigger thing. But I mean, it seems like it's a deep RPG game, but I'm like, you're driving a truck. That sounds dumb.
Well, you're in the cab. The cabs are fully modeled. Like everything, all the little dash,
little air freshener hanging off the rear view mirror.
Well, you got like turn signals and control of your lights and control of like all the different, you know, like what. I know.
It does sound ridiculous. I would love a free-to-play version of this game because actually I think it would be interesting just to try it. And based on the way you describe the progression, it actually seems like
I'm one to talk because I have actually played Densha Dego, so I have absolutely no grounds to be condescending.
And the thing is, the audience for these games, that's actually what's really fascinating to me because Gamma Sutra actually did an amazing report on, well, who plays European Truck Simulator.
Truckers that pull over and the rest of them, like, gotta take a break.
Pull out their laptop and start playing.
Actually, yeah, a lot of the people that play these games work in those industries. So
really?
So for Farm Simulator, a lot of the audience are farmers. After a long day of like
farming,
you just want to kick back
and farm.
That is a whole other fucking can of worms because I'm playing that as well, and that is a game that is basically so complicated. Like, I don't know anything about farming. Again, another thing I don't know anything about. Maybe that's why they're interesting to me, right? Because I'm like learning stuff about European trucks. And I'm
are you kidding me?
About...
Half the people who are listening at the beginning of this segment have already turned off.
I don't think so. I think most of them are mad at me and probably you for being an asshole. I bet they're like, this sounds great. Let them talk. And we keep interrupting
them. Dude, they're always like jokes.
Okay. So the shortest, most concise sort of...
Can I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
So you're in the UK right now, right?
Yeah.
So how big is the... Like, will you eventually get to go through the channel? Will you be over in Europe? Because it's...
No, I've driven a thing where you have to drive to the ferry, park your truck on the ferry, and then they take you across the thing. Well, you don't actually see that. It's like a warp you to shore sort of thing. But you basically...
How technical does it get? So the thing about... So Densha Dego, if you don't know, is the Japanese train system simulator. And the big thing about the game is staying on schedule and being able to pull your train into the station to where, you know, the cars line up on the platform where they're supposed to line up. And that's really difficult because you have to like learn how your train stops from each speed and all those sorts of things. How technical does the driving game get with that?
This truck simulator. It totally has you covered if that's your thing. I've learned that backing a fully loaded semi up is one of the most difficult and frustrating things.
Did you jackknife it?
I've only tipped over once and I had to call roadside assistance. The rest of my little fender.
That's kind of awesome, actually. I had to call roadside assistance.
Yeah. Yeah. You can call somebody and, you know, everything costs money. You fuck up your truck. You got to take it in and get it repaired, like pay for to get it repainted, whatever.
And you can imagine the free-to-play version where it's
of course I can. It's Ice Road Truckers. What they should do is Ice Road Truckers should do a free-to-play version of this.
I guess chemical spills are coming at some point.
You're like they're, right? They're, right, Spice? Like then it's got something.
You could do an iOS version of this that
there you go.
Ties into a stupid TV
show. As you're cresting, you know, you're over the freeway, you're cresting this hill, and then the sky darkens and rain starts. I mean, the rain effects are awesome. Like, you know,
so how much did you
daytime,
pay for
nighttime
this game?
Driving. I got it for half off, so I think I paid $20 for it.
Okay. Well, it's still kind of expensive.
I thought, because I was saying maybe it's $5. Like, okay, I could.
Farming Simulator I got for like $13.
Okay, so now tell me about the farming, because the farming is crazy deep.
Well, there's a couple things. It's crazy deep in the sense that there's so much farm equipment and things to do. So plowing, you know, I don't even remember what it, cultivating, sowing, fertilizing, and then reaping a field. All these things are separate steps where you're actually getting a vehicle and getting the right attachment and operating, you know, lowering the thing and, you know, driving over the weed at the right speed and then turning
around.
How
much of the game is getting sued by Monsanto? And then
right?
I was sitting here holding that joke and you jumped in the corner. Damn it.
I felt it coming. But
it's like, I've got the Monsanto
joke.
But
it's like you have this huge farm and it's big enough that you actually will have to get on a tractor and get a big, like.
What's your daughter look like?
Like grain. No
families?
No, there are virtual people that just kind of wander around the farm, but like you can't interact with them, or they're just kind of set dressing. Graphically, it is no Euro Truck Simulator 2, let me tell you.
But, this is Euro Truck Simulator 2?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is the second one. Euro Truck Simulator 2. Yeah, but Farming Simulator 2013.
It's the 2013 update, okay? Come on. It's got new trucks. Yeah.
Well, dude, the Farming Simulator actually has a $16 expansion for like Ursus, all Ursus vehicles, right? So it's like this whole new fleet of farming vehicles, $16.
In all seriousness.
What's an Ursus vehicle?
It's Ursus as a brand.
It's like John Deere. Okay.
Get with the program, Garnett.
Sorry.
God.
I love that these exist. And I love that our hobby and our pastime supports this type of game. Like, I know I'll never buy these games, but I love that they exist and someone's making money off. Like some guy sitting on a fat wad of cash right now. Like, what'd you do? Truck Driver 2, Euro Truck Driver 2. That's awesome.
I don't know if he's sitting on a fat wad of cash.
He made a second one. He's doing okay.
Yeah, that's
true. Wait, we have farming. How come there's not one of these for animal husbandry?
Well, there is.
No way.
It's on the farm. It's farming. You basically chickens and cows, and you can basically get to the point where you're not using fertilizer that you purchased. You're cultivating your own manure into fertilizer and using that on your crops. You can like
– win.
I want your truck to go to your farm to pick up your produce to take to market.
That's what it does.
Oh, my.
So you actually – and it doesn't come – the truck doesn't come.
Wait.
You actually have to hook a tractor up to
a
fucking
not huge. Euro truck, though.
No, not Euro truck.
Yeah, we want a Euro truck.
Yeah, he wants like a crossover game right now.
Well, there's – I mean, you basically – once you harvest stuff – say you harvest a bunch of wheat, right? You can put that in your silos. You have a whole bunch of silos on your farm to store, or you can dump it all in the back of a big grain flatbed and actually drive that to one of the four different selling points on the map, and they all have a different economy, different.
Can you grow weed?
I don't think so. You can get lawnmowers and cut grass, though.
Humboldt County Simulator. That's what they
need. Maybe you want to run a little risk. Let's make some real cash crops up in here.
Mods, people.
It'd be that plus you'd have a little tower defense game.
Yes.
Keeping, you know, the feds out of your space.
You have to go scout out the
growers.
National forest.
And once again, you guys are thinking like, well, I want to make this more fantastical, but I find the appeal of
There's nothing fantasy about growing weed. It happens. It's a real thing.
Well, and the thing.
I don't know how big your weed.
Have you seen the car Garnett drives? How do you think? I mean, come on. He's in the games business. He's got to be making that money somewhere. You know what I'm saying?
Dude, got to get my paper.
But he won't spend it on World of Tanks.
No. Fuck that game.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, this has gone completely off the rails. Folks, this is what happens in the summertime. We're lost. We don't know what we're doing anymore.
Hey, I thought we were having a very serious discussion about farming
simulator. I really love that you like this game, though.
I'm sold on Euro Truck Simulator. I want to play that game.
The thing that perplexes me the most is that I dropped $20 on this, and I have not for one minute regretted doing that.
Does it support controller at least?
That is another great thing. It supports – if you have a racing wheel and a huge shifter and all that shit, you can hook that up. But if you're like me and you just have an Xbox 360 controller, you do a hybrid controller slash keyboard setup, because there's a lot of – it's very sim, like to turn the – honk the horn or turn the turn signals on or radio or whatever. It's all keyboard. But – the in the cab action, they have a really in the cab action. Yes,
you can, in the cab
action. You can quote me on that. No, but like you basically the analog stick on the left is basically your you know, accelerate and decelerate, and then the top right shoulder buttons are shift up, shift down. Oddly enough, the triggers are mapped to look left and right, so you can like. You know, because you actually do have
to look at the mirror.
Oculus Rift.
And when you come to an intersection, you are like, okay, I got to look. I got to actually physically turn my head and look to the left to make sure no cars are coming because, you know, that could end my mission or you know, cause me some serious damage and I won't get my payout and all that sort of stuff. So it's here's the thing. If you were like me and were going through the Steam store and periodically would go to the Farming Simulator 2013 or the Euro Truck thing going, what the hell is this about? And you find yourself going back to it, maybe reading a little press and stuff, and you go, you know what? I'm not embarrassed to say this sounds kind of interesting.
It's just a click away.
Wait, time out. You are describing this like fetish porn right now.
How do you know that?
It's like, oh man, you know, you just keep on going back to that website and
it's not that much different, right?
That okra, man, I was going to grow some awesome
okra. Listen, you guys, you're all like, oh, I can't believe, you know, like these games, like you can't believe you're playing these. And that's kind of like, I can't believe I'm playing them either. And I can't believe that I'm enjoying them.
I'm sold. I'm completely sold.
I can't believe that you put the combat patch on Witcher 2 and you're talking about.
Oh yeah,
you're a truck driver so much, and Farming Simulator.
That's true. Maybe we should downshift into something that people give a shit about. Downshift.
Hold on, I gotta pump the brakes a little bit here. I gotta get them warmed up.
Breaker. We're going to Witcher 2. Witcher 20. Over.
No one cares about Witcher 2 anymore. We're all hyped about Witcher 3. You know what I mean?
Actually, lots of people. We should be hyped for Witcher 2 because if you got the PC version, you can install the combat mod.
Yeah.
Which brings in all of the Witcher 3 combat into Witcher 2. And that's one of the things, like a lot of people have been talking about this. It's been out now for a few weeks. There's a brand new update, the first 1.1 update to the mod.
Right.
It is a mod, so it uses CD's Red Kit. And the big question I wanted to get started with is, you know, I think a lot of people out there who bought it on Steam don't realize that, first of all, if you're on Steam, Steam is keeping your Witcher 2 updated to the latest version all the time, and it's already slipstreamed Red Kit in there. So you've already got Red Kit installed in your Steam version of Witcher 2. So that's already taken care of. And installing the mod is cake.
Like, yeah, there's an official page where you go, you know, it lists all the fixes and changes and things that it's doing. You download it. It's a pretty big zip file. I think it's like 1.2 gigs or 1.6 gigs or something. And unzip it to your desktop, run it, and it should find your Witcher 2 directory and install everything. The only thing you need to do after that is when you first launch the Witcher, it gives you that splash menu, you know, where it allows you to change the graphical options and all that stuff before you get into the game proper. There's a mods tab, and you actually have to go in there and enable the mod for each section of the game. So it's like prologue, you know, chapter 1, 2, 3, whatever. You just enable them all.
So that might actually solve one of the problems, because one of the things that I've heard for people who haven't played the game already but now are intrigued by Witcher 3 and are finally maybe getting in is that if you install the mod and play from the beginning, you'll miss the tutorial. And people have said, oh, well, if you miss the tutorial, you won't really have an idea what you're doing. But then the counterpoint is that if you are installing the mod, going through the tutorial won't help you that much because it changes things.
Well, it does. The reason that the tutorial doesn't work is because they basically made blocking automatic in the combat update. So you're not using a trigger. I mean, you can still use the right trigger, but it basically casts a Quen spell. So it's like the shield spell, and it's like a persistent one. And as soon as you let it go, it goes away. So it's – they do. They've changed the controls.
And they added the riposte.
That was in there before. It's just the way that it works is different now.
Okay.
It's still timing-based, but you don't actually have to block to do it. You just wait until – like Geralt will automatically counter – certain moves, not infallibly. Like if you're surrounded by dudes, he might counter one or two and then start getting sliced up. But it gives this, you know, it's a little bit more fluid, the combat. It's also a lot more responsive. Like the animations are quicker. You don't feel like you get locked into all these really huge, unstoppable animations where you're getting carved up while you're doing them. The roll maneuver when you're in combat has been replaced by this crazy thing where he like pirouettes away, spinning a sword above his head. So it like he like it's more of a useful. I'm cutting guys that are around me while I'm getting away,
which is good because you know if you read people who talked about this, they said that oh well you know if you one drawback to the Combat Witcher 2 was everybody right. wound up just rolling around the battlefield all the time, just like yeah, it looks like a tumbling match.
It becomes much less of a roll fest. Now, I'd started playing doing another playthrough of The Witcher 2 probably a month or so before the first combat patch came out, and I got to finish almost to the end of chapter one or whatever. And then the combat patch came out. I installed it. I started over because that's the other thing is the patch also tweaks how experience is doled out. You no longer get experience from killing monsters. It's all quest based.
Yeah, I mean it's not like it's not a mod. It's not a patch. It's a mod. It takes a lot of what the so it's done by the lead combat design on the team that makes the game.
Right,
and it's basically taking a bunch of what they were excited about in Witcher 3, which had been under development for quite a while.
Right.
And injecting it into 2.
And the moment to moment on the battlefield combat feels much better. The only reason that I went back is because I didn't feel like. You know, going through all of chapter one again and getting to the point where you can't just it seems like it'd be difficult to just play chapter one, then enable the mod because what it does is it also you know, because it tweaks experience, you start the Witcher 1 or Witcher 2 with the mod enabled and you don't have to level up any of those beginning skills. They're already filled in for you. It changes, like some of them are no longer – or none of them are two-tier anymore. You know, some of them you could plug 2 points into. Now that's just – they're all one tier. They're all sort of tweaked to be more beneficial and less throwaway, some of them. So they've really, you know, changed a lot of subtle stuff that impacts the game from a skill perspective and an experience gathering perspective and all that sort of stuff.
How much of that only, though, matters if you played the game? Like if you haven't played the game before, would you play it without the patch, without the mod, or would you play the modded version?
It's a tough one because I've only played like the prologue and like part of half of chapter one with the mod. I'd say the combat's better and maybe that's the way to go. But again, it's look at the changes because they're pretty dramatic. Like a lot of the equipment's been removed, you know, because they said there's too much equipment that's sort of useless as soon as you get it. So they basically reduced the amount of armor and weapons and all that sort of stuff. So it does feel, you know, more streamlined in that respect. But and the quest rewards have been tweaked and all that sort of stuff. I think I just had invested. I was into that sort of grittier, sort of jankier. It's maybe like the Mass Effect 1 to 2 transition in terms of like how much time and effort you have to spend managing your equipment and shit. So like the action itself, better. I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about.
See, I think Witcher 2 is on my – like is literally on my next in the queue. I think that's going to be the next game. I jumped back into Remember Me this week just to finish that up, and then I think my very next one is going to be Witcher 2. But I think I'm going to play it. I think I'm going to go straight to modded.
Give it a shot. I mean, it's still very fun. Oh, they also add. You know, they tweak some of the encounters too. So it's like, you know, you may encounter more guys because the combat is more fluid in certain areas. Like they may throw a few extra dudes at you. So.
My only concern going modded, and maybe people have done this and it's not an issue, is just because it's a mod, wondering will you hit a point where difficulty ramps or the difficulty spike isn't there and so the game feels like too much of a walkthrough, or is it too difficult at some point because
– because it didn't get a full balance play pass.
Right.
Because like we did this mod, this is cool.
Go play with it. But
yeah.
Yeah,
it's a good question.
I didn't encounter any of that, but I was again. It's entirely possible that that sort of stuff exists later on. I'd recommend checking it out though. If you're a fan of the game, and especially if you haven't played it yet, do play that game.
Yeah, I think summertime, especially this sort of the summertime, is perfect for diving into like a really good role playing game. It's the perfect time to have like a good span of time to get engaged. Nothing better than like a summer doldrums to be like really wrapped up in the fiction of a game as well. Mm-hmm. Woogie Boboof actually was giving me a little hassle about JRPGs and said, what JRPG would I recommend? What do I like about them? And what would they need to come back? So, you know, recommending a Japanese role-playing game from this generation is a bit challenging. But I think there are some actually quite good ones. And
does Persona 3 count?
Does Persona 3 count?
That was last generation.
That's last gen.
Well, it's Vita.
But it's still a port of a last-gen game.
Yeah. It's still
even, four is a port of a last.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, 4, whichever one the new. Golden. What, is that 4?
Yeah, that's also a PS2 game. So
that doesn't count.
No, that doesn't count. It's a PS2 game.
But that's a damn good game.
It is a damn good game. I think Tales of Vesperia would be a great one to go to. Excellently put together, like very classic style.
Ni no Kuni?
Oh, Ni no Kuni, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Although, I mean, I think that your filter for anime and especially, you know, that style has a lot to do with how you'll receive it. Although it's genius.
Because I feel like even within JRPGs, I feel like we throw this title around and I think like Ni no Kuni would fall into it and so would Persona. But those are pretty different games.
Yes, they are.
And there's some basic structure behind them that I guess, you know, maybe it's grinding. That's what makes a JRPG versus the Western action-focused game. So I feel like, I mean, what type of game does he or she want in this? Like, what does JRPG mean and how do you pick one? Because, like, you throw out, you know, you justify it this way. Or you want to play, what did you play on? You were going through some old Wii ones.
Well, Last Story obviously was a great. I think Last Story really embodied great storytelling and cool characters. And I think that. So you asked me like, what about Japanese role playing games? What about Japanese role playing games? Do I specifically like? I like the strong character development and creative, interesting narrative and fiction, even if it's ridiculous and fanciful. As a matter of fact, sometimes even better if it's ridiculous and fanciful. I mean, that's the whole point of a fiction. You know, I don't always enjoy all of what we've started calling, like most nerds have this picture now of what we call high fantasy, and it's all been defined by the Tolkien mold, right? And high fantasy is, you know, lots of nobles, big houses. And by houses, I mean like houses of nobility and a very strong structure to how all the royalties are put together.
Yeah, he must have written this while he was high or something. I'm just kidding. That's not what it means.
And exactly. And then the counterpoint, which is Witcher 2, is this low fantasy where it's like dark and gritty.
Right.
But I really enjoy the just out of left field stuff that you oftentimes get. Like, the thing that made Final Fantasy so popular, where it didn't need to be shoehorned into steampunk or fantasy. But yet at the same time, you could have something like as ridiculous as a gunblade. Like, here's a sword with a revolver in the base of it. How's it work? I don't know. You like take a sword shot in the middle of the sword shot. You press a button and it fires a shell from the middle of it. It's ridiculous, but it's awesome. And it's awesome in its ridiculousness. And I think that those characters also that come out of that and the amount of attention that goes into the whole aspect of the character design, from not just who they're going to be in the fiction, but how their physical features are drawn and how their costuming is done. And even if you go into the best ones, you know, the sort of music that is accompanying them, like there's always this complete vision around them because they are super driven by those narrative pieces. So that stays the similar throughout these. And sometimes they're better than others. Like, I think that if we go back to Final Fantasy 13, that despite its shortcomings, it has a number of those strengths and that we're seeing those now. Like, we're seeing those now in how with 13-2 and then the upcoming Lightning story. Like, look, Lightning is a really good character now that Andrew doesn't agree. You don't agree. You don't like Lightning. That's fine.
You're not going to say anything on the record.
Yeah,
he will not confirm nor deny.
We can read the look.
I'm just shrugging. I'm not going to let the podcast listeners actually hear anything I have to say about the matter.
Well, you know, coming out of E3, I became really excited about what's going to happen with Lightning because I thought that game, the way they had changed the combat system and the fact that they've kind of found their groove with what's happening in 13, finally, it makes a good game around that. So I'm excited about that. It just depends on how old school you want to go. Look, I watched Ariel play Star Ocean, the one that came out this generation, and for as much as it was like poo-pooed, it was a really good game. It was a good game for her.
I want the new Tales games for PS3, but more
Xillia
than Exilia and the Symphonia collection, and more than that though, the new Mario and Luigi for 3DS. Oh my god, that is must have. So that's really the only JRPG that I would recommend. Mario and Luigi, just get it. Go on 3DS.
I'd recommend Valkyrie Chronicles. That's probably, although that's not really, it's more strategy.
Yeah. Do SRPGs count? Then you open
absolutely
up a whole entire can of other worms.
That would be sort of my.
I feel like the SRPG genre has sort of blossomed, really, I mean, in the past
Valkyria
generation.
Valkyria is awesome. I mean, Valkyria is, I think, a lot of people's one of their top three or four games for PS3 of the generation.
Oh, it's excellent.
Do
it's
JRPG really 64s count? It would have been a tighter joke if it had followed immediately after SJRPG, which was the Super NES and then Nintendo.
I got it.
So I'm going to go. There's a segment left, but I'm going to go. Thanks, guys. It's been great. Let's get my finishing move in here.
All right. See you later, buddy.
Coming back for these games is easy. Look, I think the thing that all the things that these games need to do is find their groove again, which I think is what Square has slowly been working around to with what they've done with 13. They need to stop worrying so much about learning lessons from Western RPGs, because Western RPGs are different. And, you know, if you're going out and looking at World of Warcraft and Skyrim and then trying to figure out what to take away from that to change Final Fantasy, then you're right off the bat doing it wrong.
I think that was the main problem with a lot of Japanese games this generation. They saw the success of Western games, and then you have something like Quantum Theory, right?
Resident Evil.
Where they're like, oh, we'll just copy Gears of War. No, make your own thing. Do what you do well.
Exactly.
And be better at it. And I think we're finally turning that leaf where, you know what? A lot of Japanese developers are finally just doing what they do best.
How many young developers out there right now spent years prior to being in the game playing Final Fantasy, playing Vagrant Story, playing Chrono Cross, you know, and having all of that imprinted on them, playing Grandia, and saying, wow, that's so fucking awesome, and I love these games, and aspiring to be in the games business because of that. Maybe they wanted to make Japanese role-playing games, or maybe they just decided they aspired to be into the business. But then somehow or other, by virtue of Western gaming being successful, all those people who were doing all that amazing stuff felt like, oh, well, like maybe it's moving away from us. You know, maybe we need to go do something else. And, you know, hopefully now, like you said, hopefully now it is coming back around. You know, hopefully what we see with Mikami's new game is like an indication of, you know, bringing it back some. We don't know. Yeah. I do not know. It sort of ties into a question that was asked by GR, which was, do you think there is any possibility that Resident Evil would return to its original style of gameplay, creepy paced exploration and puzzles, or will it from now on be a military combat action game? Resident Evil 6 had jet fighters, tanks, and zombies with automatic weapons. In the last episode, these problems were discussed, but not much about the possibility of getting back to the old days. I fear that would never happen because there's so much pressure on Capcom for each Resident Evil to be a blockbuster.
I mean, given that Resident Evil 6 ultimately ended up being a flop, both critically and commercially, I think it's safe to say that they're not going to go entirely bombastic with the franchise going forward. I think maybe I'm not exactly sure if they'll ever return to their roots, quote unquote. But
I hope they take some cues from the guys like at Frictional, or the guys that are making Outlast, or, you know, some of these indie devs that are looking at horror in a very interesting way.
I would love to see them just reboot the franchise, to be honest.
I feel like
there's way too much baggage with the Resident Evil lore.
Yeah, actually, what you were talking about, so Andrew and I were talking about this the other day, and it started off because I was looking at Revelation sitting in our game library, and I thought, you know, I kind of want to play that because it's gotten so much fan support, and maybe that will help push Capcom back some of this direction. And Andrew had this idea about, like, just starting back over from Ground Zero.
Or just
Resident Evil Ground Zero?
Yes.
No. No, Ground Zeroes, actually. That's actually what Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes is. That's a secret.
Metal Gear Solid Evil?
I mean, they just need to remake, the which is still the best Resident Evil game, period.
Yeah. That's a high standard to live up to. I think that
Crimsons,
this point,
I mean, that is the greatest addition to that franchise.
I honestly think, you know, people are coming around and they're going to out Resident Evil at its own game before Resident Evil comes
back. Because Resident Evil isn't doing the Resident Evil thing.
Right.
It ties to what we were saying. They were chasing that Gears of War gameplay. They were chasing something that wasn't Resident Evil.
No, go ahead. No, I was going to say they're probably looking at Last of Us going, oh, man.
Last of Us isn't exactly Resident Evil. Resident Evil struck a chord that was perfect in its balance of I'm the master of unlocking,
right,
while at the same time being survival horror. And somehow it walked that line and caught that just on the knife edge of campy.
Right.
It was nerd campy
totally,
done just right.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
totally
it
different.
Was it was Cabin in the Woods, right? Because
right.
you're like you're in that spot and you're like jamming with it. If you go and look at it too closely, it might unravel some. You know, it might not stick with you.
Sure.
But I don't know how they go back and recapture that, but I would love to see them try to get back to that. I think the reason they fell into the action and militaristic side of it is that it increasingly they got caught up in how do we have the fun campy part of it without it getting too dark. They were worried about, of course, like the horror side. And the thing was, even one and two, like they weren't that horrific.
Right.
They were just they had their scares, they had their moments, and they got you. But they also had great you know like, this great vibe to them.
Yeah, no, that's true. But that I don't know. Somewhere they went off the rails, and they're somewhere
they went
that.
Off the rails. Yeah. All right, before we go off the rails, we will take this last break. A little music for you, and when we come back, Andrew wants to catch us up on a game that is finally going to arrive, and that's the Bureau, XCOM, as well as Rayman Legends coming back. So we still have lots to talk about when Weekend Confirm continues. Back a little ways for some just sort of chill out by the pool vibes from Fila Brasilia. It's a good stuff right there. It's called The Sheriff. You know, never know what I'm going to pull up for in songs. Always enjoy the feedback if you like them. All right. Andrew has
a lot of games to talk about.
A lot of games to talk about.
I mean,
You guys have
spent way too much time this summer on the podcast talking about very old games.
These games aren't out yet, bro.
So I'm going to inject some newness by talking about some games that haven't come out yet.
But
so.
Should have come out months ago. That's
but, should have, but should have come out a long time
so,
ago.
So Farm Simulator 2.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I guess Rayman Legends. That's actually I have a feeling it's going to be my game of the year. Already, but just I played maybe
next year, right? 2014 when it comes out.
I think I played about 3 hours of it at Ubisoft. And I mean, you know how much I loved Last of Us, but no, it's definitely Rayman Legends. Rayman Legends is
really
probably one.
I mean,
I'm
not. I'm not that surprised.
No,
because Rayman Legends has looked amazing, but still, Last of Us.
It is so great, and yeah, it has all that polish. So yes, I think Ubisoft finishing that game back in February and having essentially 9 more months to work on it.
Right.
The amount of polish is just incredible. And the core gameplay is just so compelling. It really is still the best use of the gamepad, I think.
Did they have that on playable at E3, not this year, but the year before as well?
Yeah, they had it at E3 last
year.
They showed off the Wii U gamepad in action. And
right.
It is coming to PS3 and Xbox 360, but I still love it on Wii U.
So what do you love about it on Wii U? What's the gamepad piece that's so compelling?
The asymmetric gameplay, the co-op gameplay, it really works so well. And just they come up with a lot of smart moments. So, for example, there's this one level. Do you remember Mario Bros. 2 where you're, like, digging through the sand and you're trying to, like, get to the bottom in order to find the exit? Mm-hmm. So they sort of have that in one area where the person on the gamepad can use their finger to dig. But there's, like, boulders and a lot of traps, and you sort of have to, like, make sure you're talking with your co-op buddy. Make mm-hmm. sure that you're making the path that's safe for them without accidentally killing them. There's another moment where you can actually use the gamepad just to draw platforms.
Right.
And once again, and there's like fluid physics. So there's lava that's like shooting out and you're trying to like block that. And there's projectiles you're trying to block that. All the while trying to create platforms for Rayman. And so once again, you're constantly talking back and forth, and it's a very active role depending on, you know, regardless of who you're playing, whether you're playing on the gamepad, if you're playing with just a controller.
Right.
And they come up with so many ways of constantly surprising you. So
essentially Legends, there's multiple worlds, and each world sort of feels like its own game, actually. So they have a stealth area where they even have guys wear the Splinter Cell goggles, and it even makes okay, up that power-up sound. And 2D stealth is just great. I mean, we all learned that with Mark of the Ninja. 2D stealth.
Gunpoint.
Yeah. Stealth
2D,
bastard.
2D stealth works really well, and it works really well in Rayman Legends. And so to have an entire, like, 10-level collection where it's stealth gameplay, it's like, oh, wow, and it's actually done really well. And then you have a completely different set of levels where they're based on music, and you know you're Rayman, you're sliding down, and every time you jump, there's music that's happening, and you have to like tap the controller at the beat in order to like keep the music going on. So that's his own thing, and then it just the amount of variety and just the way whether it uses the gamepad or not, just it is not only a terrific platformer, it's great on so many levels. There's also a soccer mini game in there, which is actually a lot of fun. It sort of reminds me of one of the games of Sports Friends, where like the pole vaulting one, where you're using your body in order to like knock a ball into a goal. That's a lot of fun. The bosses, the gigantic, amazing boss fights, and I mean let's not kid ourselves. The game is beautiful, that is a selling point. And if they shipped it out in February, I'm sure it would have been great. But the fact that they had 9 more months to work on the game, essentially, they added so much more content. And on top of that, they added Rayman Origins into the game. So when you're done
the whole game?
They put 40 levels from the original game. So that's more than 2/3 of the original game. And it's not just a straight port. They remixed it so that the stages are a little bit different, so and the objectives are different. And they add gamepad features, so there are moments where they incorporate all the new stuff. And it uses the new engine, so it has all the new lighting effects and whatnot.
I feel like Rayman is the game that the core gamer audience knows how good it is and has always just sort of floated along at the edge of that, but never had the, at least not in North America, breakout. Oh my God! Acceptance of you know what? Wow, Rayman is up there in Mario and Sonic territory.
I mean,
because it's been legitimately from a game standpoint to that point, but I feel like it hasn't achieved that reputation.
The thing about Rayman Origins is that it's a great platformer. It also was really challenging, so it could have turned off a lot of people because the difficulty was
Super Mario World had pretty damn challenging parts to it.
But I mean, Rayman Origins was at certain points turned into Super Meat Boy. You know, like it gets pretty insane.
Right.
So they definitely dialed down the difficulty for Legends. But to make up for that, certain levels when you beat them, they actually do a remix version of that,
like a hard version,
where it is timed and you're going backwards through the level, and it's actually super fun. I love those levels where. It's once again, it's sort of Meat Boy-esque where like
the dark world, light world thing.
Yeah, and there's like spikes everywhere, and like a single thing will kill you, and you're just and you have to like rush through it in like 30 seconds, but you're just constantly hitting retry over and over and over again. So they do have that still, and so Rayman Legends Rayman Origins was a great platformer, but Rayman Legends is just beyond that. It is a great platform because it has all those platforming levels, but it has the music levels, it has you know, the stealth levels. It has
like what I'm hearing. It goes beyond being just a great platform. It sort of escalates.
And the co-op really transforms it. When you think about how the gamepad worked with Mario U, you're just tapping platforms. And yeah, sure, that's fine for...
Well, you described like 6 or 7 different things that you could do in Legends, and one of them was the only thing you could do in Super Mario.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's like...
And it wasn't even done that well in Mario U. But on the game... I mean... I sort of feel bad that PS3 and 360 owners won't be able to experience that part of the game because I think that's really unique and something that I haven't really seen in games and really tells me, hey, maybe Nintendo's onto something with this Wii U.
I think it's Ubisoft is onto something because when I saw that game when they first showed it, I was like, man, Ubisoft is literally kicking Nintendo's first party Mario platformer in the ass
really,
with this thing.
It really justifies having a Wii U. If you have a Wii, I'm not saying you should go out of your way to buy a Wii U just for this game.
Right.
But if you have one, it really it exemplifies what Nintendo's strategy was.
So what's
the
chance, because this is really strong, what's the chance this begins a pendulum swing back from where multiplayer has gone? One of the questions that I actually didn't bring into the show but was in the discussions thread was this great idea about how, you know, multiplayer, especially over this last generation, has developed into this weird solo experience of you sitting on your couch by yourself but then playing virtually with all of these other people. So it's multiplayer. Whereas multiplayer used to be this great social experience of you sitting on the couch with your friends. The couch co-op thing is like the buzzword for it. And this sounds like it recaptures
it is
all of its glory.
It is a perfect couch co-op game, and I do not want to play it any other way.
What's the chance? Like, I think that there is some growing sentiment amongst gamers of like, oh, you know what? Yeah, sure, it's nice to play Call of Duty at 1 a.m., but there are other times like I'd like to bring back some of that. Like, can the pendulum swing back?
I mean, so long as you give people flexibility,
you don't think so.
Are
you being serious? Like, that's just like, no, it ain't going
to
happen.
It's not going to happen. People have moved on. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go for it.
People have moved on towards the convenience of online gaming. I think if you live in a dorm with friends and you share a TV and you don't all have individual little TVs in your room, then maybe you'll sit down and do this shared experience. But the day of getting people together, like, hey, come over, like finding hardcore gamers or core gamers are more than social, casual. I mean, this isn't Rock Band. It's not that type of game.
No.
Finding that group of people to come over and play a game and sit down and catch if you don't already all live together or you're not in a communal space, it's not going to come back. And I love one of my friends, Ben Wiggins. I mean, he's out here and we reminisce. We played Sega Soccer Slam last weekend. We fired it up on the GameCube because we missed that, you know, sitting around or whatever. But that's
a pretty fun game.
That's a great game. That's us. And I feel like people don't miss that. It's horribly inconvenient. The experience might be okay, but it's not –
I don't know. I disagree.
Awesome.
There are people who get together every weekend to watch baseball together or to watch football together or to watch soccer together. And then like that's their event. I think that this could definitely swing back. I mean, look at what Andrew's describing. What Andrew's describing sounds like a fucking blast.
And the thing is, Rayman will be fun if you play it by yourself, if you play it on PS3. Once again, it's solid enough as a platformer. So I think ultimately that's key. You have to give players the flexibility to play however they want, whether it be, you know, online, solo, or couch co-op. So I think Rayman is flexible in that regard, but man, if you don't do the couch co-op, I feel like you really are missing something.
Sports is more passive. You're eating, you're hanging out, you're getting drunk, you don't know what's going on, you're talking in the background.
You've never seen me play games.
I love these types of experiences, but well, I think part of this might end up being my finishing move. Whatever. I can get into it. I mean, we started with Counter-Strike, and will that come back? And then what do we need to do to get Resident Evil back? And, like, let's get this couch co-op back. It's not going to fucking happen. Just move on. Like, these were great experiences, but they're done. And to be nostalgic for it, that's great. That's fantastic. I get that. I love the original Star Wars. It doesn't mean a Star Wars is going to get back to what it was. Who cares? Just enjoy that. And games medium has moved on. And what we're nostalgic for, like these –
see, I think
– Co-op. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, the technology is going to support that but not in the same way, right?
Like, that's what I'm cool with.
I don't think it's going to be everybody getting on one couch and doing that. I think you're right. That's kind of going the way of the dinosaur. But I think that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of unexplored possibilities with these new boxes about how you can bring – you know, make it an online experience, but connect you with the other player in a way that you don't feel like you're just talking over the headset.
That would be awesome.
You know,
like, cool with that.
Like, I mean, you know, Xbox One could do a picture-in-picture, like, you know, video chat while you're playing whatever game, and like, or if you're playing a game where you really have to communicate or do charades or whatever the hell you have to do, like, that's all possible, I think, but I think it's going to go in that direction.
Maybe it's a second screen thing. I mean, it's not strictly a nostalgic thing for me so much as that was what we were doing then when the technology was there. What could we do now? And I mean, like the summer, the sort of like midsummer, like laying in the sun daydreaming is like, well, like, yeah, like with the technology we have now and with the different pieces of hardware that we have now, what could we do that's really interesting? And so Andrew describes this thing with Wii U, and you're like, shit, someone finally got the tablet thing right. This sounds like something would be amazing to sit around and play with a friend.
Yeah.
I agree that the experience sounds great, but just going back to your question, will this reinvigorate that style of couch co-op? I don't think anyone cares about it.
Well, maybe reinvigorate's the wrong word, but will it bring some momentum back into telling develop? Like, well, I guess it depends on success.
Unfortunately, I don't think this game is going to sell well. I mean, I think it's going to be great.
I think it'll sell on. I'd be surprised if it doesn't sell better on Xbox or PS3 than it does on. It'll probably sell best on Xbox.
I think the Wii U audience is hungry for it. And
they are hungry,
and I think they are the target audience for it. I think, there might not be the same kind of audience for couch co-op, but I think Nintendo still appeals to people that really want that.
When does this come out?
It comes out on, I think, October or November. But the great thing about Rayman Legends,
right after GTA.
I think.
And right before new consoles.
GTA's September 17th, so I mean, you got.
And the thing is, I don't think the GTA audience is like, oh, well, now I'm not going to buy Rayman Legends.
Well,
No, they are. I think they are. They're people that have money that play video games.
Well, GTA is not coming out on Wii U, so that's.
But that's not a decision tree in your mind where you're like, oh gosh, which one do I want more? Like, for most people,
I hate being the pessimistic person because I feel like I often am. But I feel like this. I think we can look back at this, and this will be like, how the heck did Square think that Tomb Raider would sell 10 million copies? Like, it's a great game, but it's not going to do it.
Ultimately, I didn't think Rayman Origins was going to sell. Certainly not well enough to make a sequel.
Well, it kind of didn't, but they had the tech build and had this engine build.
No, apparently it's done really well for them. Granted, I'm assuming it's a lot cheaper to make a Rayman game than it is to make, you know, Watch Dogs or Assassin's Creed. But I think
resources.
I think the takeaway for Rayman Legends, I think the most important takeaway, especially for Ubisoft, is, hey, maybe you can make something really special if you just give games more time.
If you actually try.
It's not a question of trying. Like, I'm sure Assassin's Creed 3.
You guys need to know that Andrew really maligns Assassin's Creed 3 for its unpolished state.
And it could have been so amazing. It really could have been the best in the franchise if it just got a little bit more TLC. Ultimately,
it could have been much better with more polishing. I think we'll all be in agreement on that.
But there's still two other games that I want to talk about, and I know we're running out of time, so I want to rush
through.
Keep
going. You don't have to rush. Just...
The Bureau, XCOM, the Classified, totally my jam. If you liked XCOM, I think they definitely nailed the transition of making that strategy game into a third-person shooter.
So it's not simply Fallout combat system with... Oh, good.
No, so I think the key takeaway is that it is Mass Effect. It is very Mass Effect-y. Mm-hmm. It's you and two squad mates fighting aliens.
One of them is a Krogan. You
know. Pretty Mass Effect. And even the powers are very much like Mass Effect. So you have the ability to lift someone out of cover, and then you can tell your Garrus equivalent to use its sniper to get a critical shot.
Right, okay.
So a lot of the elements are very similar to Mass Effect, which is fine by me. I liked Mass Effect's combat quite a lot. The key difference, though, is that you have so much control over what your squad mates do in terms of literally telling them what path to take. You are drawing a path for them to take, showing which cover they have to take. And even when you take cover, you actually even see the little shield icon from the Enemy Unknown game where you can see if it's partial cover, if it's full cover, if it's exposed. So you get a lot of information. And it really feels like a strategy game because you actually you could probably beat the game without ever really shooting your gun.
One of the fascinating things that Andrew was telling me about when he came back from seeing this is some of the prototypes that they had gone through.
Yeah, so clearly it's been a troubled game. I think the most interesting prototype that they made, it turned into a top-down game. So it was third person, you're running, but then once you entered the tactical mode where you command your squad, the camera goes top-down and you move your characters. And
they're like, wait, this is Far Access already made this game.
But yeah, then they're like, shit, we just literally remade XCOM. and so they're like, how do we get that tactical gameplay but make sure it's still...
They're like, here's how you... Wait a
but
second.
But you know what? In the journey, so like reading Andrew's preview and like being up on the Bureau, I think the thing that comes out is that you get this sense now that this troubled project was troubled for so long because they weren't thinking about XCOM. They were trying to lift an XCOM veneer and put it onto something else. And as they prototyped and prototyped and prototyped and XCOM Enemy Unknown got made, it seems like somewhere along the line in this process, the light bulb sort of went off and they went, oh, rather than trying to do something else and force it to be XCOM, let's make an XCOM game. Holy cap, let's make an XCOM game. Right. And it seems like they finally sort of like that all sort of started to, I get a sense it's starting to come together or started to come together finally.
I mean, I think they, the consequences of having agents die, that really carries well in the third-person shooter. So if you have a squad mate die and you have that permadeath, the smart thing that XCOM, the shooter, does is at the very beginning of the game, they give you level 5 characters, like they're maxed out, and you're using all their powers, and you feel really great, and you're like, oh man, you know, I can't wait to use them. But then you lose them, and you have...
A lot of people hate that mechanism, by the way.
You have a team of level 1s, and you're like, oh man, I can't do what I wanted to do. And so as you start building your characters, you start getting attached to them, being like, oh man, I'm finally... That guy's a level 3 tactician, you know, this guy's a level 2... And then if you lose them, you're like, no, you can't do this to me again. I already lost that high level guy. I can't afford to lose another one. And
so it's basically hardcore mode.
Yeah, it's it is definitely a hardcore game. I think the original marketing was probably to chase a more broad mass market audience.
They wanted the Fallout Skyrim audience.
But
that was...
the end result is a game that might actually be more hardcore than Enemy Unknown, because the randomness and like having people die, you feel bad. But if you wanted to, you can get to the point where it's like, I should just restart the game. I'll just restart the campaign because it's all random. Whatever. I'll just do it again. If you get to the point in XCOM where you're like, shit, I'm fucked. I can't beat this game. I have to restart a 20-hour story campaign. Like
right.
that thought process just seems a lot more frightening. It actually feels like the stakes are much higher in the shooter version, just because.
And as we learned when we talked about XCOM and Enemy Unknown, there are people who jive to that. There are people who really like that's cool. Like they want that investment because that investment then gets the reward's that much higher, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're that deeply into it, then the payoff is that much more satisfying.
And
although I stopped naming my characters in hardcore mode.
Would you run out of Weekend Confirmed cast members?
Well, yeah.
Within like
one,
the first level.
Two.
Yeah.
Not only that, but you're like, and then like,
well,
do I continue?
So the fascinating thing about XCOM
Jenny
shooter.
From sixth grade English.
The interesting thing about the
take
Bureau,
point.
The Bureau is that on the harder difficulties, there is no resupply of your soldiers. They are a finite resource. You can't generate new level ones. So you could just get to the point where you're
done.
You just fucked over.
You have lost
done.
The earth.
Then a guy comes over to your house, takes your disc, and snaps it.
So one thing that I am concerned about the Bureau, I think the gameplay is really fun and really great, and I think I'm gonna have a lot of fun playing it. But it's pretty clear that it sort of came together at the end. And I feel like the polish isn't really there. And I think they're just trying to shove it out.
I mean,
they're
it's
like,
an unfortunate situation.
They finally figured out the gameplay, and they're just like, all right, let's just ship it. It's not going to be that pretty. The cutscenes aren't going to be that great.
The trailer looked great, though. It looked like real people.
The live action trailer.
Yeah,
it's that case where they finally got something that clicked, and now the publisher sees that and says,
and they're like,
oh,
shit, we got to. We
That'll
gotta
work.
Rush this out before we make Grand Theft Auto V. So.
Well, yeah, yeah, or hold it until afterwards.
So, yeah.
Disappointment.
But that's the Bureau. I think I'm super excited for it. Really think that's coming together. If you liked XCOM, I think you'll like the Bureau.
What's in the Bureau? Like socks and underwear.
It's the quote unquote origin story of the XCOM organization. Apparently, it is actually canon. So, if for some reason you actually remember the story of XCOM Enemy Unknown, it'll actually explain why some of those things happen. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm sure three people played
your
XCOM.
Point sniper died because you sucked at the game. Like, that's the canon. I do remember that.
The last game I want to touch on, Payday 2. I think it feels weird. I'm like super positive about three different games because usually I'm the negative Nancy about these games. But Payday 2, also super cool.
That has nuts in it, right?
Nuts?
It's a candy bar joke.
God damn it! You made that joke earlier today too. And it's like,
the best part was
watching. And the sad thing is, I got that joke when he said it.
The best part was watching Andrew's look on his face because he was thinking about like what he's going to talk about the game, and I watched it sail right over his head. I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Anyway,
sorry about that.
So Payday 2, if the title wasn't clear enough, it's is a sequel to Payday. And actually, it feels like the game that Payday should have been. So Payday sort of devolved into like a poor man's Left 4 Dead.
Right.
Where you're just...
Yeah.
But instead of zombies, you're just fighting coppers.
Which, yeah.
Which is, parents, I guess, love that.
But the original premise was pretty cool. Get together online with friends and pull off heists.
Yeah.
And that is so much better represented in Payday 2 because it's theoretically possible to complete the perfect heist where it's like, all right, we have to sneak into this guy's house. We have to find his safe. We have to, you know, get his laptop, you know, implant, you know, incriminating evidence there, steal the files out of the vault, and then just leave undetected. So that's theoretically possible, but something always goes wrong. Someone always, like, steps into the sight of a camera that, like, oh, man, like, we forgot about that. Or, like, you know, so, you know, you're drilling through the safe and, like, a guard walks by and he's like, huh? And so and once the stealth gets ruined, then it all goes to high hell. But it is so much fun trying to plan for the mission. You know what you have to do. You're just not exactly sure how you're going to do it. And the great thing about Payday 2 is that pretty much every element is randomized. Not the map, but the camera placement, the guard placement, if there are going to be guards, how many guards there are. I think the best moment that describes why I'm excited for this game is each of the heists are connected. So we did one mission. We robbed the jewelry store, and then actually we robbed the jewelry store, and then we had to make a drop off. So we sort of fucked up the jewelry heist, so we had cops chasing us. So that unlocked a different side mission where we had to do like a final stand and wait for an escape van. So that's like a separate thing. And then once we escaped the cops, we had to make the drop off, and so the drop off is completely randomized as well. So there's like this radio. It's like, okay, go into the abandoned train car over there. It's like, okay, we're gonna do it. You know, make sure you bring the make Ooh, sure you bring
hungry, just starving.
Too many payday. Too much payday, yeah. Conversation.
Now I'm like peanuts.
Make sure Snickers.
Make sure you bring the bags of loot. And in our scenario, a helicopter comes and the voice on the phone is like, okay, throw the money or throw the diamonds into whatever. Throw the loot into the helicopter and they'll drop bags of money. And we're like, this seems super shady. So there's four of us and, you know, we're like keeping an eye out. You know, maybe they're going to ambush us. And the cool thing is, you know, one possible scenario, they just didn't show up. And you're just like, you can't make the exchange. You're not going to get any money for that mission. That's one possibility. Mm. Another possibility, they'll screw you over. You throw the loot and they'll just be like, bye. And then you have to try to like chase them down or fight them. Or they'll screw you over by trying to kill you. But no, it went really well. It's like you know, the helicopter leaves and it's like, is that it?
Well, that's what's cool about it. I mean, what's cool about this game is that there are all of these opportunity moments throughout each of these scenarios, and it's all procedurally generated from there. It's like, what happens next? Well, what happens next depends on A, how you played your characters, yep. And B, how the computer decided to sim this version of the game.
And
or this
so,
version
it,
of the story.
It, so it does a really great job of just keeping you on your toes all the time.
Well, it's like like a slightly more advanced version of the game director from Left 4 Dead, like you were talking about, yeah. Where it's like, oh yeah, okay, we're going to make the game's making decisions based on your performance or based on certain things that happen. That's
yeah.
Really cool.
And there's a lot of risk reward in there, so you can actually choose to get higher paying jobs that are a lot more difficult, but they could be 7-day affairs where you have to do like 6 different missions, and if you fuck up any of them, you lose. So you can be on like the 6th day of this like multi-million dollar heist. And
did they give you a sense of how many?
There is a rating scale, and you'll be briefed on, you know, how extensive a mission might be,
right?
And you'll get like a general idea of what you have to do. With the money you earn, you can actually buy like blueprints and get more intel that way. It just does so many smart things, and I just had so much fun. It is rough, but I really want to be able to get together with a group of friends.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you guys are getting a crew together, let me know. Well, maybe we'll...
And yeah, really get a perfect heist going on.
So there you go. Andrew Yoon loves games again.
Yeah.
The summertime is here. Andrew Yoon loves games again. All right. Let's wrap this sucker up with obviously, we got to get Jeff someplace so he can get some dinner on or something.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I don't
know
what happened.
Dinner and cough drops.
I had a huge ramen thing before I came here, so that's maybe why.
All right, so let's do our finishing moves.
It's the weekend, and it's time for Finishing Moves.
Yeah, catching up on a lot of games, which is one of my favorite parts of summer. So knocked off Nier, enjoying the YouTube part of like catching up on the B endings are really cool. I again, no regrets for where I am with that game. I enjoyed finishing it, and I'm also enjoying getting the story beats, but I didn't want to play more of it. And now I'm wrapping up Remember Me, and boy, I forgot how much I am such a sucker for its artistic nature, for its music and environments and the way it looks on screen, and just the cool dynamic music that starts up when you start into combat, because it's like Jean-Michel Jarre is there like making dynamic music for you while you're fighting. And it's just, yeah, look, the fighting gets a bit dreary, especially now I'm in chapter 7 and I think there's only like 8 chapters to the game, and they throw really criminally cheap scenarios at you, and it's the Batman combat, but the Batman combat with the dial-a combo thing, it's fun. I just still, it's so resonates with me from its atmospheric and artistic touches that I just can't hesitate to recommend it to you. Maybe not for $60, but absolutely, if you see that game sitting someplace on sale, you know, like when Best Buy does a clearance or Target does like those clearances at the end of the aisles, pick it up. It's a ton of atmospheric, movie-like, Luc Besson-like enjoyment as a gamer, and the combat is fun enough, and the game, I think you'll find it satisfying, and I'm really enjoying the artistic nature of it. There's something about that just clicks for me. Have you played it, Christian?
I have not, but I have a friend who swears by it, and it'd be my equivalent of a Steam sale at some point.
Yeah, or just borrow it from him when he's done with it. I mean, it really clicks for me, and I understand that in spite of all of its shortcomings, of which there are ample, but the high parts and the getting engaged in it and the music and the artistic nature of it just really works for me. Who'd like to go next? Jeff?
Sure. I would like to highlight a couple of iOS things that I've been playing lately that are pretty awesome. Actually, the first one is I haven't really spent that much time with it, so maybe calling it super awesome is a little early, but I like what I've seen so far, and that is Breach and Clear. That is Robert Bolling's company's.
Just came out yesterday.
Yeah, just came out yesterday. It is basically Frozen Synapse meets XCOM with a, you know, sort of a more arcadey, sort of easy, you know, interface. So you're talking about like 5 or 6 minutes per level, and you have a squad of 4 guys. You go into rooms and you set their sight lines and make sure, and they automatically kill whoever's in their sights. And it's pretty cool. It's, like I said, it's
very interesting story. I believe it was on Gamasutra, but it might have been gamesindustry.biz, about how they were originally free to play and elected to abandon that in favor of the premium model.
Super
smart.
So
it's $1.99.
Yeah, it's $1.99, but
it's on sale.
It's a day one 50% off sale, so it'd be like $4. It's pretty cool so far. If you're into that sort of thing, I don't think you'd go too wrong for a couple bucks. The other game that I really, really have been enjoying, I'm almost done with it, is Tiny Thief, which is the second Rovio Stars game, I think, that they published. Five Ants is the developer. And it's basically like a really great art adventure game. You'll play this little teeny minuscule thief, and it's all about, you know, tapping stuff in the right order on screen to make these animations occur and to steal whatever it is on the level that you need to steal and sneak away. Really clever, really funny. Some of the puzzles are, now they're all fairly easy. You're not going to really get too stuck with it, but it's definitely a great sit down for 5 minutes and solve a level sort of thing. It's pretty cool. Tiny Thief.
Christian?
Real quick, first, if you guys like podcasts from people that play video games but don't talk anything about video games, Stuart Nocht, you might know as Wombat, from Cheapest Gamer, we have one called Uninformed Opinions, where we pick a topic. I feel like we're in our groove. We just talk about random shit for half an hour. It's on iTunes. And also, Bioshock Infinite fans, I get it. I do. I get it. I get that you loved the game so much. For me, I enjoyed playing it, but it never clicked as anywhere near a Game of the Year contender. And this is before Last of Us came out. And I just couldn't get past the problems.
Elizabeth's AI kind of being wonky, the story having, in my opinion, some real valleys and some real problems, and you finding a hot dog in a trash can, like all of that stuff I couldn't get past. The Last of Us, I think, is my favorite. It is, as of right now, my favorite game I've ever played. I love it so much, and I realize that it has problems. Why can't – you're surviving. Why can't you put one more knife in your pocket, Joel? Make it fucking happen. I get all that. And now I feel like I'm on the other side of those conversations that I had with BioShock Infinite lovers where I'm like, it's dumb. You have a hot dog in a trash can. It's stupid. All the combat is you're zipping around on a circular freaking zip line. That's dumb.
Christian, you can't carry that extra shell. Why can't you do that? It's stupid. You're surviving.
Matter. No, the game is more than that, though.
Oh, okay. Sure. Of course it is.
And so I recognize...
Hot dog in a trash can, bitch.
I know. I recognize I'm on the other end of that argument now. That being said... If you like BioShock Infinite more than The Last of Us, you're wrong. you're so wrong.
Oh, God.
I get it. I really do. I understand. And so those Infinite supporters out there, I understand your feelings. I disagree with them. And I love The Last of Us so much. And I know Ozzy's playing it. And I wish I could go back and experience it again for the first time. It was phenomenal. And I talked about it on this show before. Some of the moments I had, and I know the AI is broken for some people. I just never encountered any of that. My combat experiences were all wonderful and magical, and I loved it. And again, Naughty Dog, fantastic. If you haven't played it, go play it.
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
Pass on BioShock, that piece of crap.
Oh, dear. Andrew, bring it home on a positive note for us.
Oh, shit, positive?
Oh, or, well, whatever note you want.
Well, I do agree. I think The Last of Us is also one of my favorite games of the generation. I absolutely love that.
Seminal game of the generation,
I
for
said
sure.
Ever.
For sure.
So, by the way.
It's still not F-Zero GX or Ikaruga, so. But close. They are very similar, at least. So I wanted to talk about the Mass Effect anime. What is it called? Paragon Lost, I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not good.
That's the show, guys. That's
yeah,
it's positively awful. See that?
So that's what you learned from Anime Expo is that the Mass Effect anime is not good.
You don't even Anime Expo was a lot of fun. It was revelatory, but in terms of, oh my god, what that movie is so bad. Like that, I. It should be a crime to make movies like that.
Is this the one they gave you guys for free a couple of
episodes? Is this one directed by Uwe Boll?
No, I've seen Uwe Boll movies.
They're fucking awful, aren't they?
Still better. Still better than this. Okay, this movie is so bad. And I think it exemplifies like everything that I used to find annoying about anime, but none of the cool stuff. None of the like, none of the art. None of the... Oh, my God. The...
Oh, I hate it so much! Oh my god,
it is a frustrating movie, and I've seen every terrible EA anime spinoff that they've done.
Dead Space,
Dante's Inferno.
Is the Dead Space?
Why do you put
terrible?
Yourself through this?
I don't know. I used to really enjoy writing reviews of them just because it's fun to sort of just rip something a new one. But Mass Effect actually just takes it to a brand new level.
It's so bad it ripped you a new one.
You're like, you win, EA. Yeah. All right, I won't subject myself to any more of this.
And it's just crazy to think that a franchise like Mass Effect, where the universe is so rich and there's a history of great storytelling in there, that's the one where EA just can't get it right. They can make a Dante's Inferno anime. They can make a fucking Dead Space anime. They can't. But fucking Mass Effect?
So Shepard, you got a ship?
Oh, yeah, I got a ship. It's kind of... You want to go for a ride?
Well, Shepard's not even in it.
Ship.
Never mind. Sorry.
Well, Shepard can't be in it because, you know, well, who would that Shepard be?
I didn't even know it. So it's after that? Oh, I guess
It's actually... So it takes place before Mass Effect 2, I think, and it tells the story of... Vega from Mass Effect 3.
And how he,
but it's
how,
terrible. So don't get drawn in. Don't
do
it. Don't listen.
And how he encounters the collectors. There is a hilarious choice that he makes at the very end. I'll just spoil it for you guys, just to save you the
anguish,
to save you the trouble. So there's this chick that he like falls for, and he's like super into her, and she's plummeting to the planet's surface for a variety of reasons. Conversely, there's a collector ship that's filled with like tens of thousands of people that's also like on fire and crashing into this ship, and he's like, you know, and he's like, you know, who do I save? And then the scene goes black, and he's getting a commendation, he's getting an award. It's like, you know, I know it's been, you know, sometimes we make hard choices, you know, this is the hardest choice of them all. I can't believe that you saved the life of one over the lives of many. And he's, and then the next 10 minutes, just him crying and like bizarre shit happening. It was a oh yeah, and they do a flashback where it's like, Vega, he's not coming, is he? Oh my god, but he said he would. It's just it's so good. So
wow.
Bad.
I think I pre-ordered the collector's edition version of this so I could get the statue.
Well, since I have a surplus of liquor thanks to Euro Truckers 2, I may
man. Okay. This is completely off the rails now. Oh, my Lord. All right. Thanks very much to everybody listening. Ozzy, great job filling in Del Rio's shoes, keeping us on track. Micah there taking care of the boards and music for us. Thanks again, of course, always to our friends here at the Atlantis Group Studio in the Santa Monica. Great place to do voice work if you're out there in the game dev world. Just saying. Christian, the Stotts Comedy, anything? What do you want to
Second Tuesday of every month at UCB, improv versus stand-up. We've been fortunate in every show. It's been a sellout. August show is phenomenal. It's Maria Bamford and Eddie Pepitone doing stand-up, and the improv group is Sassy Bluff, which is Alex Berg, who's the artistic director of UCB, Nick Mandernack, you'll know from Hip Hop Penguin and other things, and Dave Thune. It's freaking amazing, August 8th. Mm-hmm. And Double Jump, the last sketch has been turned in. It should be coming out hopefully at the beginning of August. Stuff looks really good.
Excellent. And hey, my fellow games media members out there, Mr. Jeff Mattis is awesome at freelance work. So you should give him freelance work. And game publishers, you have games titles that are coming out this fall. You need mock reviews. He does mock reviews. So.
Dude, that is – thank you for saying that. Yeah, I am looking for work. Appreciate it.
So – you know how to get a hold of him. If you don't, get a hold of me, and I'll get a hold of him, and you guys will get connected, and it'll be like one of those email introduction chains. It'll be awesome. Everyone loves to see those. And, of course, Andrew running the Shaq News for us, making sure that the only site for video games with news in the name.
I mean, I actually haven't verified that, so don't
That was your pitch.
That's an internal pitch. Now it's on the internet. Goddamn.
No, it's on your back now. On your back. Live up to the standards. Live up to the standards. It'll be all right. It'll be good. All right, everybody. Do jump back into the thread. We will run the questions thread again. You guys did an awesome job with that. Thanks so much for listening. That is your Weekend Confirmed, and we are Ghost. This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.